That was We're Hardcore by Gord Downie, and this is the Splash Page Podcast episode, is it 38 or 39?
I don't even know. It's a lot. It's a high number. We're not counting all the special episodes either, so we're up to like 100 counting those.
Well, I mean, we don't even count like all the episodes we broke into pieces either. It's 38.
Right. Episode 38.
And I'm Chad Devitt, and with me as always is Tim Callahan, and
special guest.
As a special guest, after three episodes of us not being together, we thought for the first one back, we'd add a third person.
Is that what we thought?
Well, no, I think that's what the third person thought.
Well, who's with us tonight, Jed?
I think he can introduce himself.
Oh, I can?
Is there anybody else here?
I guess so. Usually we introduce ourselves, so why not?
You know, because that I've seen that on every talk show. The guest comes out and introduces himself. The host goes, hey, bring him out. And the guy comes out and says who he is.
Right. It happens all the time on Conan O'Brien. Hey, who's this guy?
It's Joe Casey.
Joe Casey. Comic Books Joe Casey.
Can you believe it?
And this is the first time we've had a third podcaster on the show, a third guest, a third speaker. And it turns out there were some technical issues that took like several hours to resolve.
This is not the first media cherry I've busted, so.
Ooh, that feels so good.
Yeah. So let's get on with it. And I warn you, at any time I may be chewing on a salvia leaf, so, you know, watch for that. But those only last 5 minutes. So.
Good to know.
Yeah.
So basically, Joe Casey's come on the podcast because, well, he likes comic books. He likes podcasts. He likes us a lot, apparently. And he's got a let's just go right into the pimping. Let's jump right into that.
Yeah, the product shilling.
The product shilling of the there's a Butcher Baker, Image Comics. You've been hyping it for a little while, sort of discreetly. Little secret images being released. Turns out that you spoiled it like months ago back on CBR. But yeah, it doesn't matter if that happened.
It was discreet except for the interview with you, Tim.
Right, the interview when you mentioned it by name and talked about who you were working with. And
Yeah,
but nobody really noticed that. Nobody reads comic book resources, so it's no big deal.
Apparently not.
it took a while for people to like actually go back and be like, wait a minute, he did mention this.
Yeah, a few people did get it. A few people did actually remember that interview, so...
That's good. I'm glad I have those three readers who pay attention to what we talk about.
They exist, and they will post on message boards, apparently.
Yeah, that's what happens on message boards. People post stuff. So why don't you talk about Butcher Baker a little bit, whatever you can tell us, and you know, make people want to rush out and buy it today, even though it's not available yet.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're still, 3 months out from release? But it's never too early to do a little pimping, right?
No, never.
You got to tell me. I'm just kind of curious because I really haven't talked to anybody about it aside from, you know, an interview here and there about the infamous 30-day teaser, which wasn't really 30 days, but it was the month-long teaser campaign, and if it had any effect at all on anybody's brain, I don't know. But I was hoping you guys could tell me.
I thought the images were provocative, definitely. It was like, oh... What's this? What's this now?
Yeah, and I mean, even though I never said it online or out loud to anybody, so it'll sound like I'm revising history in a way that makes me look smarter. I remember the first image with the universe that was like shaped like a woman but with a penis? I'm like, that looks like something I would see in a Joe Casey comic. So.
Yeah, quite a reputation I've forged for myself.
You've got that market. That's your niche right there.
Yeah.
The penis woman universe shape.
I'm so proud. And that's a major character in the book, actually.
Really?
I stand behind that character. Not physically behind it, because I was scared. But.
That's you behind her. Oh, it's hard to see behind the penis.
That's right. But conceptually, I stand behind it.
Yeah. And then later, with some of the other teasers, there's a couple things that reminded me of your work, like... one of the characters saying, I am the American Dream, or something like that, reminded me of the Constitution of the United States and Automatic Kafka saying the same thing. Stuff like that.
Yeah. There's definitely some connections, or I guess a lineage to that. If not that book, that kind of book. And, you know, what this is. But we'll see. I mean, certainly Huddleston's a very different artist than Ashley Wood. So it might not be quite as impenetrable in some places, but it's still, I think it's still got that same spirit. Maybe, hopefully. Who the hell knows? It's fucking 7 years ago I wrote that book. God, I hope it's different. What am I saying? It's nothing like what I'm saying.
It's exactly the same, and it's completely different. Because yeah. You're a different person 4, 5, 6 years later.
I am.
Are you writing it in that sort of improvisational style, though? Is that the approach you're taking?
No, that is sort of Godland specific. This one, this is a full script. Because, I'm not opposed to Huddleston. And he has done, you can write a script for an artist and they can, in some instances, treat it a little looser, which I encourage if there's better ideas that spring up. But I feel like I have to kind of front load my enthusiasm a little bit more just because I've got so much shit going on that to write a Marvel style plot, and this sometimes happens with Godland, to write a Marvel style plot and then, you know, you don't know when you're going to get the art back. It could be a month, it could be 4 months. And to still have your enthusiasm for that initial idea. I mean, with Godland, I kind of turned that into a style where if I get the art back and it's 3 months after I've written the plot, I just kind of look at it with fresh eyes from moment to moment. And I do just sort of let it fly. But with something like this, Butcher Baker is a little bit more tightly plotted. It's a little bit more constricted. So to just kind of let it fly, I mean, I've kind of learned from the Godland experience that I can let it fly even as I'm writing a full script. So you get the same effect. It's a little bit more controlled.
So as far as letting it fly while you're writing a full script, does that have to do with sort of, as you're creating that script, not being so concerned about a long-term structure? Is that part of it? I mean, how much does the sort of longer-term narrative play into that decision-making?
It's not much. It's more moment-to-moment. It's more about, gags and bits and interactions within the scenes. I mean, like I said, Butcher Baker's it's got a fairly tight plot, but within that plot, I leave myself room to go on little tangents and allow for moments that I just think of at the time. It doesn't prevent me from getting to where I want to go in the story. But it makes it more fun for me. And it's certainly, Kafka was pretty fucked up. I think this is more fucked up.
More, really?
Yeah.
In terms of because you're just able to go in any direction?
Well, I don't know what you'd call it, like a sort of a tough guy subversion phase where I've got these characters and Butcher's just one of many that will kind of be rolling out in the next, year or two, where it's that, sort of machismo to the nth degree, but totally subverted by anything I can think of to throw at that kind of character. I mean, I kind of did it in Wildcats. I, broke Grifter's legs and put him in a wheelchair and just kind of deballed him quite a bit because he's such a cliche to begin with. Mm. But that's the only thing I know how to do with characters like that. So it's kind of like having your cake and eating it too. You've got a kind of character that is commercial on the surface and, plays into all the tropes that, fanboys or probably just even people in general can get behind, but then I go in and totally, fuck with those characters as much as I can and make it not at all what you would expect to see from, your Grifter, your Punisher, just name your tough guy asshole character. So I am probably playing both sides, but, whatever. It's my book, goddammit.
And is it being your book outside of, like, Wildstorm, going back to Kafka, like, give you a bit more freedom in that way? That's how you can sort of go off in more things? Image won't restrain you as much as a corporate environment might?
Well, I gotta be honest. I've really never felt restrained on anything that I've done for companies or for myself. I mean, maybe because, I mean, being a professional is about going into a situation. If you're going in and you're writing, you know, Superman or whatever, you're not unaware of the parameters going in. I mean, you'd be an idiot not to know certain things that you can and cannot do with that character. But those are pretty general restrictions. Those are sort of common sense constrictions. And once you sort of have those ingrained, you find a lot of room to do all kinds of things that editors would have never thought of. And so they don't know that you're being subversive. They don't know that you're doing something, that you're going off the reservation, because it's just so whacked out that you know, that's kind of part of the game. You know, they can't keep up. I mean, my last year on Superman, I don't think my editor knew what the fuck I was on about, you know, but I wasn't doing anything that was going against the grain of the character, so I could get away with all kinds of wacky shit. You know?
Like making Superman a pacifist?
Yeah, but that's not that wacky, is it?
I mean, I thought it was pretty, not necessarily wacky, but definitely far out there for what you'd do with the character, because a lot of people seem to think of Superman as the guy who punches big robots kind of character at times.
Well, that's, you know, my feeling on that is if you think Superman's not a pacifist, then that says more about you, you know, the reader or whoever. I mean, then it seems pretty obvious to me. Why wouldn't he be, you know?
No, I agree, and that's something that I really, really thought was great about that final year, and something that it's kind of ruined reading the character at times for me, just because it seemed like a very obvious extension of the character, and then other writers kind of not living up to kind of the challenge of living up to those ideals that Superman would probably have.
Well, I can't speak for anybody else. I can't imagine, you know, I don't think it would be many people's first instinct to challenge themselves on such a corporate character, you know, because in a way, what do you get out of it? I mean, I was entertaining myself more than anything else, but I certainly wasn't setting the world on fire. People weren't flocking to read that book just because of, you know, my take on the character. Unlike, you know, I think most writers probably, when they get on Superman or get on the X-Men or get on, you know, Batman or Spider-Man, they don't do it to not be popular, you know, with the readership. But for some reason, that never really occurred to me that, you know, maybe I should play up to exactly what the readers might want out of a particular corporate icon, you know?
Well, it's almost like that idea of, in a lot of writers' hands, and maybe it's not so cynical as this, but it's almost like if they made Superman a pacifist, it would be just so they could get that final rolls up his sleeves and finally punches out the bad guy. Almost like, you know, the old man Logan approach, where like he doesn't pull out the claws and then he does, and it's a big, huge heroic fanboy moment. But you kept it as, and trust me, I've heard a lot about your final year on Superman from Chad, because every time we mention anything about Superman, he's got to be like, well, you know, Joe Casey did it best with the pacifist Superman. But that you went with it, that you didn't kind of use the pacifism as just a kind of a rope-a-dope, that you didn't fake people out with it. You were like, no, this is who the character is, period.
Well, because what's the point then? Because basically the ending or the end point that you're talking about is basically saying, you know, I was wrong to be a pacifist, and now I'm really going to do what I was supposed to do, which I didn't believe, and I still don't believe.
Well, I remember you saying in an interview at some point that you kind of regretted having Superman explicitly say he's a pacifist. Crossing the line. I thought I read that you said that somewhere.
I'm sure I regret lots of things. I regret most interviews that I do, I end up regretting. And I'll probably regret this one too, but I think that I probably said it. I probably shouldn't have said it explicitly, because I you know, ultimately I wasn't really trying to make a big point. It was more a challenge to myself as a writer, and that's how it really started, which was, how can I write Superman where it doesn't just fall into that trap where he's punching people out, you know, which to me makes him look more like a bully than anything else. So from that challenge, you know, you have to make it work within the logic of the character. And, you know, I mean, that's not a big leap to take. That he doesn't have to punch anybody, so he wouldn't believe in that, and, you know, and so on and so on. It wasn't my intention to sort of build up some big thing where he stands on a mountaintop and says, fuck you, I'm a pacifist, which is why when he says it, it's fairly off the cuff. I thought maybe I could sneak it in, and, you know, but people certainly, you know, caught on to it, and they noticed it, and I don't know whether or not that got in the way of the stories or not, you know.
Well, don't you think it's an inherent challenge to write an action character who is a pacifist, who doesn't automatically, especially in a visual medium, to create that kind of conflict that's suitable for the character when the character won't resort to the physical violence? I mean, there's obviously an inherent challenge there.
There is, but when it's Superman and the guy can fly and has heat vision and all kinds of cool shit, it's less difficult. I did a Batman thing that I went into it going, you know what, I'm going to write this as though I were, you know, that I was Stanley Kubrick doing Batman. So I'm not going to use any of the tropes. There was no Robin. There was none of his villains. There was no Commissioner Gordon. There was no Bat Signal. There was barely a Bat Cave. There was barely like a Batmobile. And the challenge was, could I sustain, and this thing was like fucking 120 something pages, if, or longer maybe. I just thought, well, can I sustain a Batman story without it turning into Batman's greatest hits? You know, which was, you know, at the time, right around the corner. You look at a story like Hush, and that was Batman's greatest hits.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, that was a big, huge success, and, you know, mine disappeared without a trace. So, again, career-wise, not the smartest thing to do. As a writer, that's an interesting challenge to me.
Was that the Tenses book?
Yeah. Milestone in my career, or a millstone around my neck. You decide.
I think a classic is what it is.
Yeah. Like a neoclassic.
A neoclassic. A 2012 neoclassic. I can't wait for the oversized hardcover reprint in 2012.
It does have Cully Hamner on art, so you never know.
Cully Hamner's, yeah, absolute Tenses, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the corporate characters, this is something I saw on the CBR forums last week that kind of surprised me, to be honest, where people were talking about your Uncanny X-Men run, and there was a lot of people saying that they really, really liked it, which I don't remember being the case at the time.
Oh, it wasn't the case at the time.
Yeah, which I kind of found that funny, just because it seemed like a weird, either it caught on later or all these people were not saying they liked it at the time.
I think that, I haven't read it, but from what I can see, there's been, I don't know, maybe some abuse of that property since I left. So in hindsight, it makes what I did seem a little more... You know, I don't know. Acceptable? Who the hell knows?
it wasn't that bad after all. Yeah.
Yeah.
But well, so when you were at the time when it was coming out, I mean, what was the backlash or what were the fan complaints at the time?
Well, I mean, there were complaints from the minute that we were announced as the guys coming on, and you know, it's hard to imagine now. I mean, people were getting up Grant's nose about it. And I remember at one point he actually went online and had a response that was fairly snippy, you know.
Really?
So, you know, but, you know, this it's so weird. It was, you know, 10 years ago. It doesn't seem that long ago, but it was a totally different, even different internet culture, you know.
Yeah.
So they definitely came at us with pitchforks. And, you know, in my case... Justified, absolutely justified, because I was, you know, full of piss and vinegar about, yeah, I'm going to do all this stuff, and I had all these notions about, you know, not just about the X-Men, but about comics in general, and, you know, the kamikaze in me was like, yeah, I'll take the biggest franchise that existed in comics at the time, and just, you know... I really went off the reservation in a lot of ways. And some stuff I just wasn't a good enough writer to execute very well. Some stuff I don't ever think that I had, except for Sean's couple of issues, I never really had the right artist consistently on that run. Those are just elements that made it less fun than it could have been. Mm. But I just didn't have the juice at the time. I didn't have the mojo for the X-Men to make the few ideas that I had work very well. I mean, I don't know when it was. It was a little while ago, but I stumbled across some old notes that I had taken when I was kind of thinking about what I would do with that book. And Jesus Christ, I mean, considering what did see print, the stuff that I thought of that I discarded, oh Lordy, I had some terrible ideas for that book that thankfully didn't see the light of day. Really awful, awful things, you know, that I'm ashamed that even entered my brain and luckily didn't see print.
And you're not going to share any of them with us, are you?
None whatsoever.
Yeah, I was going to say, though, the stuff with Sean was definitely of better quality, especially, I think, your final two issues, which seemed kind of like a prologue to Wildcats version 3.0, where it was Warren Worthington using his corporate abilities to take down the Vanisher's drug trade.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a cool idea, but it has nothing to do, really, with the X-Men core concept. I mean, absolutely nothing. I mean, you know, you could stretch it and say, hey, look, you know, a mutant made good, you know, and high up in the corporate world. If I'd hung around, I was thinking about having that character fucking run for office, you know, be like the first mutant presidential candidate.
Yeah, I think was it Logan or someone like that made an offhand remark to him saying, like, you should run for president? And he was kind of like, no. But in that way that you could tell it was in the back of his head, oh, yeah, I should do that.
I'm sure I was seeding it then, you know. But again, now look, that again, it's, I could, if I worked hard enough, I could connect that to the core concept of the X-Men, but it's a stretch. And I just, in hindsight, I don't know if I just want to spend that much time spinning my wheels just to kind of force feed one of my goofy ideas down the throat of a fan base that's actually very passionate about those characters and really takes them to heart. And, you know, it's not worth it to piss in their Wheaties, you know.
But one of the things that Chad and I have talked about, because, I mean, he's about 10 years younger than I am. And so, I mean, he grew up reading comics in the 90s. And where guys of my generation, guys in their mid to late 30s, sort of have, at that point, they were getting into comics right during the sort of end of the Bronze Age and when things really started getting shaken up in the 80s. And, you know, sort of the Geoff Johns approach to comics where there's sort of a status quo and things need to really revert back to the core. But Chad grew up reading comics when all the characters were getting replaced. Like, you know, his Green Lantern is the Kyle Rayner Green Lantern. And so his concept of the status quo is a status quo where things get shaken up and a new regime comes in. So don't you think that for something like the X-Men, the core concept could possibly be about that kind of transformation, but it just depends on the generation of readers you're trying to target?
Well, it can't. Yeah, I agree. It can be. But the problem is when the other book is being written by Grant Morrison and really is his take on the X-Men's greatest hits, which is exactly what he did, and rightly so. It's hard to, and we weren't in competition at all. That was the best part about that gig, was he and I kind of, you know, we weren't working together, but we were just in the trenches together.
Right.
And, you know, who was going to compete with that? I felt like, if anything, it was my responsibility as a fan of his work to just stay the fuck away from everything he was doing and just stay far away. Because I was reading it as a fan too, and I wouldn't want me mucking around in his waters. You know, I wanted sort of pure uncut Grant Morrison X-Men, you know. So I was very content to just stay away from what he was doing. And he, to his credit, he tried to bring me in more when we were sort of in the talking stage and the planning stage before either one of us had really started writing.
Right.
He was extremely generous in saying, hey, you could do this, and and it could work this way. And I was very adamant about not doing that because at the very least, I just, you know, I just didn't want to muck up what he was doing. You know, I wanted to read what he was having any of it. I just didn't want to mess it up. And, you know, luckily that was the case, you know, so I'm thankful for that at least.
And you can see that sort of impulse, especially with his DC stuff, Final Crisis and Batman, where you see that some of the other writers maybe, you know, maybe they want to, or maybe there's some sense that editorial wants more coordination. And then when they end up kind of dipping their toe in what Morrison's doing, like it never quite matches up with his story.
Well, yeah. But I mean, I think it's funny that, and this was in that interview that you and I did.
Yeah.
That I was the first guy that pitched having, you know, Damian be part of something else besides Grant's book, you know?
Right.
And at the time, it was like, even just the reaction to that pitch was, I mean, Grant was all for it. He was like, that's great. But it was something that probably separated people from it to a certain degree, you know?
What do you mean by that?
Well, just in the sense of, not that they, you know, I don't think, not that they thought that no one else could write that character, and not that it was any deference to Grant. It was just, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to have that character in there? That's the sense that I got.
Huh.
And then now, of course, he's showing up everywhere. You know, so people got over it. Just, I guess it takes everyone else, you know, a year and change to get to where I was, you know, fucking back then. I don't know. Who knows?
How did you find stepping into, so you not, can't come up with another way, Grant's shoes, as it were, when you did a dance, working with...
I found it rather pleasant, actually. No, it was fine. That was, I wasn't stepping in any shoes. The characters were barely there. You know, what you saw in Final Crisis and the sketchbook that they put out, that was all he had. I mean, in talking to him, you know, Grant's kind of guy, if you sat down and go, hey, what do you think? Just off the top of his head, he could come up with a bunch of shit. So even though, again, we talk all the time when he's in town, I purposely did not try to pick his brain, because what's the point of that, you know? Otherwise, you know, he might as well write it in that case. So it's not really a challenge. They were cool characters, so it was just fun already. That's how I looked at it, you know? They were cool characters. I had some, you know, a story or at least an approach that I thought would work. I had to kind of maneuver around the edicts that didn't come from Grant, but came from editorial that I thought were kind of boneheaded, you know, but, that's, you know, that's always part of the gig to get around those things.
So was that something where they had the concept for these different series and then they brought you in, or was it something that you pitched?
Oh, I didn't pitch. They called me about it. And the only idea they had was that, you know, something is happening in Japan. That was kind of one of their... something bad has happened in Japan. And I was like, all right, if you say so. And if you'll notice, if you read the book, I totally kind of gloss over it and allude to it. And then ultimately in the last issue, they just kind of go, yeah, Superbat buys the island and fixes everything.
Right. A problem solved.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, that's what superheroes do. They solve problems. That's what he did.
Huh. So it was just a matter of, and so they knew that they wanted these characters to launch many months later after Final Crisis, and then they gave you the parameters. They said six issues?
Yes.
And then
yes.
They said, something's happening in Japan.
They did have a basic, you know, they had the characters, they had the title, they had this sort of plot device, and I was like, all right, you know, good enough, fair enough, and then I just went off and just sort of did the rest. And they had Chris Cross lined up, and that was interesting to me, because he and I you know, we wanted to work together. We wanted to work together for a while. So it was a situation where all the elements lined up. I had the time to do it. And, you know, just did it. Turned out to be, as with most things lately at DC, turned out to be more of a pain in the ass than I expected going into it. But, I stand behind that work. I think it turned out okay. There's enough bits, like, again, there's enough bits and gags and moments in it that made it worthwhile for me and hopefully for people who read the damn thing, you know?
Yeah. What draws you to working at the big two like Marvel and DC at this point? What still keeps you going back to do miniseries and little projects like this?
Well, nothing's got me back there lately, so I think that... I don't know, it's hard to say, because I don't want to just chalk it up to I like to write, and I'll, you know, if I have an opportunity to do something, I'll tend to do it. I approach writing in a very Lester Bangs kind of way. I mean, I just like to do it. I like the process. I like the activity of it. I'm not one of those guys that, you know, likes to write to say they've written. You know what I mean? I like to write. It's what I do. It gets me off or whatever you, however you want to say it. That's provocative enough for an interview like this, but, I just like to do it. So if an opportunity presents itself that's not too dumb, to be perfectly honest, that's just doesn't insult me in terms of where I am in my career, I'll tend to at least consider it, at the very least consider it. And more often than not, I'll take it because if nothing else, something like that, you know, Super Young Team book or the Zodiac book at Marvel or whatever, you know, retro Avengers series I do, at the very least, it's an opportunity to write. And if I'm a better writer at the end of something than I was at the beginning, then the exercise was worth it. No matter what the response from the readers is, or no matter what it does for my career or not does for my career, or not, you know, the effect it doesn't have on my career. If I grow as a writer, then any gig is worth considering, no matter where it comes from. You know, I mean, why else would I do, that thing for Dynamite with those public domain characters? I did the thing with Alex.
Yeah, the Project Superpowers stuff.
Right. The Daredevil thing.
And then the Meet the Bad Guys.
Yeah. I mean, I did it because Alex and I are friends. It was fun to kind of bat things around with him. And ultimately, I mean, that part is the rewarding part. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, then you got to write the goddamn book, which sometimes you kind of go, Jesus, why did I agree to do this? But... even those situations are not too painful because even within those gigs, those less than ideal gigs from a career point of view, I'll always find something in there that makes it worthwhile. Whether or not it's some storytelling trick I've not done before or, you know, pushing the craft in some area that I haven't explored before, there's always something that keeps me engaged and entertained, you know, and that's the only reason to do it at this point.
Do you consciously, in those cases, try to set out to do something different? In other words, like you'll give yourself some sort of, not artificial, but some sort of hurdle to jump over that may or may not be something that is inherent in the series itself. But it's like, I'm going to try this, and I'm going to try to apply this in this circumstance, and that's part of how you play around with that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, like, the Zodiac book, you see in the first issue, there's a lot of time jumps, a lot of them, more than I've done in anything else. And going into that, I thought, this is sort of a technique I'll try to use. Now, oddly enough, by the third issue, those time jumps are gone.
Right.
Because I kind of burned through them in my own head. I was kind of over them by the middle of the second issue, I think. But that was a technique that hooked me in to, you know, starting on that book. So it's always something like that. I mean, I'm a craft whore. I'm always interested in something that's going to be challenging to me. And even if I'm taking from somewhere else and applying it, you know, if I read something that I did really cool, I'm going to kind of do my version of that in this other project. I mean, I don't see that as, it's not a ripoff to me. It's more like sampling, you know. And I've done it in things that no one's ever picked up on that I've seen, you know, in response. I mean, just the weirdest things that have influenced me and that I've put them in another book that I've written. And to me, it's plain as day. It's just like right there in front of me, like, oh my God, I totally lifted this technique or this approach or this trick or whatever. And I haven't seen, a lot of people haven't picked up on a lot of things that I've done. So I guess I'm doing a good job of covering my ass, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly something that you can definitely see when artists are doing it. It's, I'm going back I'm in the middle of that two-part column on Shaken's Cody Starbuck. And all of a sudden with the second installment in Star Reach magazine, like he's just doing his Alex Toth impression.
Right.
And it's so blatant. And, yeah. And obviously you can see that with other, like when Jim Lee tried to do the Sin City technique with Deathblow. I mean, it was cool to see him experiment with that different style, but it's so obvious. With writers, it's a lot harder to tell because, you know, it's not visual. It doesn't just stand out on the page.
Well, but it's also, I mean, I'm trying to remember what issue number it was. It was one issue of The Intimates where it was really just the origin of Sykes, the character that doesn't speak, who has the null field around his head. And that whole issue came from reading the Dan Clowes Death Ray issue. Mm.
Huh.
And just being so charmed by that and being so like, wow, you know, look what he did here. So I mean, I felt like I was just lifting techniques just left and right in that issue of The Intimates. Now, of course, I can't imagine that anybody who read The Intimates, just the layman, maybe, if there is such a thing or if there ever was such a thing, is sort of like the layman, you know, Wildstorm fan, might not have read Death Ray. And read that issue, The Intimate. So, to me, you know, on some level, maybe I feel like, maybe I'm paying it forward a little bit, you know, something influences me or inspires me, and I can, you know, somebody that shows me something that comics can do that I didn't know they could do, that is a big deal to me to this day. You know, I crave that. I'm always looking for somebody to do that for me. And I just happen to be in a position where I can take that inspiration and actually apply it to my work. So to me, yeah, it's, to me, there's really blatant things, but maybe not so blatant to the readers, you know.
Well, now that you mentioned that, I can start to, in my head, kind of picture some of the stuff that you're talking about, but I didn't pick up on that at all, and I've read both and actually, like, wrote about The Intimates a bit, so, yeah, I feel kind of stupid now.
It is one of those things, though, as a critic, even if I've, you know, read a wide variety of these things, I do tend to compartmentalize superhero comics so much. And I, you know, you kind of put them in a separate ghetto where you don't think about how they might be influenced by what's going on in the independent or alternative or, you know, literary comic scene. At least they're separate in my head so often.
Well, as a writer, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but I sort of count on that. Because otherwise, there's a lot of things that I do that are, you know, people could immediately call me on. But I have that sense that it's still very compartmentalized, you know, in terms of there are superhero fans who read superhero comics and they don't know who Dan Klaus is.
Right.
Let alone would they ever read something that he ever did, you know. So I kind of count on that. So it makes me look more original when those superhero fans read something that I've done, where I've lifted something or been inspired by something. You know, it's fine with me. I mean, I'm not trying to be an advocate for, you know, like saying, hey, superhero fans, read more independent work. I could care less. Read what you want to read, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to cross-pollinate what's influencing me, what's inspiring me, the stuff that I'm reading that I'm getting a kick out of into my own work. I mean, that's, comics are already so self-reflective that I feel like I'm just sort of taking it to the next level, you know?
So what I'm hearing is that your last year on Superman, you were just ripping off Jimmy Corrigan. You were retelling that story.
I wish. That would have been radical. I was actually ripping off, I wasn't ripping off anything. That last year of Superman, I remember what's the documentary called about the Muhammad Ali Foreman fight? The good one. When we were kings.
Yeah, when we were kings.
And there's a section in that about, which, you know, look, is probably overblown because it worked in the documentary, but there's that whole section about, you know, Muhammad Ali being more than a fighter. He was a political figure. He was an aspirational figure. He was just revered, especially, you know, in Zaire where they were. And I just was like, that it was so powerful to in the context of that documentary that, you know, and I was writing the book at the time, and I just thought, well, that's an analogy I can make with Superman, because within the DC universe, he is the most aspirational figure, and yet what he's known for is something that in the DC universe, you could swing a dead cat and you'd hit a superhero. Mm. But what is it that makes Superman somehow above the rest of the pack, you know? And it's not just because he was first, because now he's not even first, you know, in the continuity. So I sort of infused that sort of the myth of Muhammad Ali that people have and to this day still have, you know, and that really informed the character for me, you know. Now, of course, I remember I wrote something that was, I don't know if it was an email or just like a little, you know, mission statement as I was going into that last year, where I said it out loud. And I think it was to the editor and to the other writers. Like, look, this is kind of what I'm thinking. And I'm sure they all just kind of went, what the fuck is this guy talking about? You know? But it helped me. So, you know, who cares what anybody else thinks, you know? But that's not something that, I mean, forget about the pacifist thing. No way was I going to say in the comic itself, or even in an interview. Well, of course I'm doing it now, but who listens to this anyway?
Yeah,
right?
Let's be honest.
It's not something I would say. I mean, imagine the backlash that statement would have. It might have it now too. Who the fuck knows? But at the time when I was actively on the book, you know, I think there'd have been some people out there that would have had my head, you know?
Huh. Yeah, I mean, for me, I can't imagine there being a backlash from that statement, but I don't understand how the internet fan section works. I don't know what people are thinking.
There's always a backlash.
I remember in one of my columns, I mentioned an up-and-coming artist, and I referred to him as like, oh, the best artist you've never heard of. Like, it's just a statement. And people are like, I have too heard of him. How dare you insult my intelligence? Like, come on.
Right.
Come
right.
on, people. Back down.
No, wait, who was this artist?
It was Jason Latour.
Oh, I'm going to pile on. Yeah, that's totally wrong. How dare you say that?
I know. What was I thinking? I'm such a dick. I don't know.
I worked with Jason like early on, like before anyone had ever heard of him. Kirkman hooked me up with that guy.
I think it was.
And we were doing a backup in one of his old Funkatron books. And I think we got about two or three installments into it. I don't know. Maybe the book went away or I don't know what happened, but I was on the Jason Latour bandwagon early on.
Nicely done. Well, I remember, because I've been a couple, he was like working like a bastard. He was churning out pages, but none of it was going to hit until 2010. And so, there were a couple years there where there was nothing from him. And up until that point, he'd done a few little things here and there, but it just happened, everything hit at the same time. And I'd seen some of the stuff, and I knew it was absolutely fantastic work. And so the whole idea is, hey, you know, here's a guy who's going to hit big with a lot of stuff, and yet people still turned it into this negative comment. So come on. People. Come on.
Another lesson learned, Tim.
The internet is full of lessons for me.
How do you view the internet? Because I remember years ago. I think it was you were doing a column for Newsarama, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And you spurred off some big thing where you insulted people on the internet and everybody was like, fuck Joe Casey, son of a bitch. So how do you view the internet now? What's your relationship with it?
Well, I was an early adopter on the attitude that, you know, ultimately, internet feedback doesn't matter. I just happened to say it. Again, something I said that everyone was probably thinking and, you know, caught shit for it, but that's fine. I like to establish my relationship with the internet crowd early in my career. And get the animosity out in the open, you know, right away. How do I view the internet now? It's ubiquitous. I mean, there's a difference between the internet, which is really just a resource, and all the social networking things, you know, the Twitter, the Facebook, and all that stuff. That I don't have any time for. I just don't have the time to do it. So I just stay away, you know, and it's not difficult, you know. I'm still fine with there just being email. That's good enough for me, you know. But I don't really know. I mean, I don't really think about it all that much. I mean, it's so ubiquitous. And it's become such a part of comic book culture. You know, that kind of feedback and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's hard to imagine that era when, you know, all there was like Amazing Heroes and the Comics Journal and, I mean, just print magazines, you know, which I loved. I mean, I was a huge fan. I craved those publications in the 80s when they would come out. So on one level, the internet satisfies that need to sort of have sort of continuous input, you know, about the world, but also about my industry. But where it applies to me, I'm not all that interested, you know. I mean, the Butcher Baker teasers, it was fun to put those out. And I kind of, every so often, kind of saw what the feedback was. But it wasn't like I was every day going, what are people saying about it? What's the, you know, because it is what it is. And you know that you can almost break it down mathematically, you know. Half, you know, a third of the people like it. A third of the people hate it. The other third just don't give a fuck, you know. And you could apply that almost to anything across the board. And once you plug that formula into your head, you know, what is there to look at other than how will they insult me today or how will they like me today? So that's kind of how I look at it these days.
So how does that fit into your overall sort of approach to the audience in general, as far as when you're writing? And I know you have talked about how you write to kind of amuse yourself and that's what I do, and that's what I hear from a lot of people when they're talking about their own writing. But in general, for your various types of series, whether it's one of the Marvel kind of fill in the continuity things, or it's something that you're doing for Image or whatever, what kind of audience do you imagine if it's not always just writing to amuse yourself?
I don't know. I mean, I always have that idealized, you know, like vision of an audience out there that just buys the comics and reads them and then puts them away, and they're entertained for the, you know, 10 minutes that they read it, and then they never really think about it again. There's a part of me that wishes that audience was out there, and they probably are out there to some degree. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I like to see the kind of the shit that flies around on the internet, all the flotsam of the culture. And, well, you know, when other people get into a snit, I'm right there. I love watching the train wrecks. You know, I love those car crashes on the internet. I mean, the Dan Slott thing, hilarious. You know, I don't want to get involved in that stuff personally, but I love to watch it. You know, I'm very voyeuristic in that way. But I think it would be, I mean, I've had those moments early in my career. And, it's kind of a been there, done that feeling for me. And at this point, the way I approach my work is that I try not to even talk about things publicly until I have a really good grasp on what it is I'm talking about. Like, people who gave interviews just because they just got the gig, you know, I'm taking over, you know, whatever, and I just got the gig yesterday, and now I'm publicly talking about it.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense to me. What are you going to say? You know, if you haven't really sat there and thought through what you're going to do and how you're going to do it and what you're going to present to the audience, and, you know, you don't really have a handle on the type of entertainment that it's going to be, it seems pointless to just sit there and talk. You know, I mean, that's just like patting yourself on the back in public. Hey, I got another gig, you know.
Yeah. Here's what I would say. I would say, oh, I'm taking over Superman. He's going to walk the earth for 12 issues, and it's going to be great. That's what I would say.
Yeah. what's the part where you say, but I won't write all 12 issues?
Well, I haven't planned that far ahead yet, so.
Right, exactly. So I try to avoid that scenario. And that, believe me, that cuts out a lot of potential, you know, problems in your relationship with your readers, you know, via the internet, which is kind of how I look at it. It's just, it's a mode of delivery. I mean, you're using the internet to disseminate and deliver information about a project you have coming up, or, you know, I mean, I guess I've been around enough that when I do an interview, you know, we talk about, I mean, just like we're doing now, you talk about the latest thing and you sort of get that out of the way. And then you just kind of talk about what's going on. You know, people want to know, you know, opinions on, you know, digital delivery, which is, to me, is the most boring fucking topic, you know, ever.
All right, Chad, cross that off the list.
Yeah, but okay. I mean, people want to talk about it. So, you pontificate and you say your piece. So in that respect, you're kind of delivering a piece of your personality, which, if that informs the work, if that, for anybody out there, if that informs the work, then that's cool. But as far as, I'm way past that, you know, sort of 2000 era, hey, let's all be rock stars kind of vibe, you know. I just think that's so played out and such a waste of time. I mean, we're clearly not rock stars, you know. So why pretend to be that?
There is that weird push, but it makes sense. It's like, you know, writing for CBR, even though the kind of writing I do isn't really like, hey, let's go interview these people all of a sudden because they were announced on this book. But I have, a couple of years ago, I covered San Diego, and I did, you know, I transcribed panels and all that stuff. And I kind of felt like, oh, I'm supposed to be covering the show. So once news breaks, I guess I'm supposed to be interviewing these people. But I could not care less about it. I was like, oh, Dan Slott, you were announced as the writer of this book. And I didn't even have the heart to ask him any questions about it because I didn't care. And yet that's the kind of thing that the internet pumps out. Like all these different comic book websites just pump out that breaking news and the media interview. And they're like, there's no substance to any of that stuff.
Well, you gotta, I mean, I fully admit, I'll play things very close to the vest for my own self. I love it when anybody else wants to, you know, pontificate about their inner thoughts and their views on, you know, Afghanistan or whatever the fuck they want to talk about that has nothing to do with comics. I'm right there. But to me, there's a difference between what I enjoy, you know, as a voyeuristic audience member, and what I'm willing to kind of put out there for, you know, public dissemination. I mean, you got to keep a lid on some of this stuff. I mean, they call it, you know, it's for whatever, you know, if you want to even put comic book creators in the same universe as someone who, you know, people are really interested in, you know, celebrities or whatever, sports figures, whatever, where people might want to scratch them a little bit and find out what's, you know, underneath the veneer. I just don't know why people would even care. It's the work that matters, you know. Maybe I'm wrong, though.
No, what? I definitely agree, and that's something that I know, talking about conventions with Tim, it's something that I can never get into, because even just the idea of meeting and talking to comic creators, my attitude's always been, okay, what am I supposed to talk about? Why do I care? Like, I like their work, but why would that necessarily make me want to engage with them on any other level necessarily, if you know what I mean? That's something that Tim and I have discussed before.
I think there's a compulsion and I'm not ascribing it as particularly negative at all, but there's that feeling that, and I've had it, you know, where it's like, it's sort of that those lines get blurred. Like me and like my work. And in comics, especially because it's such a personal medium, it's a personal medium for people who are readers. It's a personal medium for the creators. The culture itself, feels very personal, you know, because it's such a niche, art form that that line does get blurred, you know, and to the point where it can't go the other way. I mean, it's hard to, I see on the internet, it's hard for people to think that a certain, and certainly it's been leveled at me enough times, where people think that you're a dick, and so they're not even going to entertain whether or not your work has value or not. You know, you're a dick, so fuck your work, is basically, you know, there'll be that, you know, feeling there. So to combat that, you might overextend yourself and try to be, you know, I don't know, extra likable or have more personality or present yourself as, you know, somebody who, you know, you want to hang out with, which it's like, oh, good Lord, you know, that it becomes this cult of personality. And then it gets into even darker areas of, you know, some guys that we all know who we're talking about, which is basically this, you know, envy me. I'm going to drop some names. I'm, you know, and, you know, don't you wish you were me kind of presentation of them, of their personas online. That stuff, I just shake my head and go, well, all right, if that's how you want to play it. But it, I mean, it doesn't work for me.
But I can see how there's that compulsion to kind of be a huckster for your own work, especially, I mean, if you're a creator and you're behind a table at a comic book convention, whether it's a table selling your trade paperbacks or single issues, or whether you're at a table that's at, you know, Marvel or DC booth, like, there's got to be that impulse of, hey, I'm charming, because you don't want to just be all moody and depressed behind that table as people walk up to you. But it is kind of an artificial cheerfulness in a lot of ways. It could get
well,
into that.
You can hide behind the excuse like, well, that's what Stan Lee did, because yeah, that's what he did. But I don't think anyone's mistaking Stan Lee's persona as some genuine, you know, that's like, that's not how he is in real life. I know that for a fact, you
right.
know. So why anyone else would go out there going, no, this is how I really am, you know. I mean, I'm genuine, and yet I'm going to say these things that make me sound like a real prick, you know. There's only one Stan Lee. You know, I mean, that's really what it boils down to. And I don't think he was trying to set some standard, like, this is how you got to be in comics if you're a creator. This is how you got to present yourself in public. And it's something that worked for him. And we're all in on the joke when it comes to Stan, you know?
Right.
But not so with almost everybody else that goes that real self-promotion route, you know? And look, I mean, pimping your work is necessary. But man, I mean, there is a real line that gets crossed more often than not. That's, you know, I watch out for it for myself. I just don't want to go there. I don't see what the end game of that is, you know?
Now, yeah, those conversations can be awkward on a personal level. It's, I mean, if you go to those conventions and, you know, ultimately some of the creators are doing the same thing that just the washed up celebrities who are just charging $20 for an autograph are doing. They're just, you know, smiling so that you'll buy their thing because they're there to make money. But if you want to have a conversation with them, there's not much beyond that.
Well,
and I mean, you know, the people that I've met at conventions are not necessarily like that, but you do see that side of conventioneering.
Well, what I think is funny about the whole thing about getting comic creators to sign your book is I feel like more often than not, I mean, there's the people who, you know, they think it's going to increase the value of something. Okay, fine, if that's what you want to believe. But I think more often than not, to get a creator or anyone that you like as an entertainer to sign something, it's really, an excuse to talk to him. It's sort of an artificial formality. And as long as you're here, you know, signing my books, let's talk about something that, you know, let's talk about your work. Let's talk about this thing that you did. I mean, one thing, you'll never really see people lined up to have things of mine signed, because I've never put out that, I've tried to put out the vibe that if you want to have a conversation, you don't need to have one of my books on hand to have that conversation.
Right.
You know, just let's just have a conversation. I'm totally game, you know. Even if you want to come up and say, oh man, you suck, then, you know, I'll have that conversation, you know. I mean, it might end in a fight, but whatever. You know,
Have you ever actually had someone do that?
Never. Never.
I've heard other creators say they've had the odd experience where someone will come up and say, like, you ruined this character, you sucked on this book, sort of thing.
I think that it comes down to quite honestly, if you're a fan and you see a certain creator and you hate their work and you want to tell them, the only thing that you have to think of in your mind is you have to look at that person physically and go, can I take them? And if you feel like you can't, you're probably not going to say jack shit. If you feel like you can, you might go for it. You might give it a shot. You know, no one's ever done it to me, so maybe no one thinks they can take me. I don't know.
Yeah, you're such a badass that no one would dare.
I know. Look out, watch out. But I mean, I really think that's part of it. I mean, you know, that is, there is that nature. It's like, you know, can I write a check that my ass can cash? You know, and if that's not the case, you know, it's likely that no one's going to say that to your face. You know what I mean? Because you never know how someone's going to react. I mean, I honestly wouldn't know how I would react if someone came up to me and said, hey man, I hate your work, it sucks. I think I would probably just say, well, have you bought enough of it to make that judgment? If they say yes, I'll say, well, thank you very much. You know, that's really, you know, you bought it. That's kind of all I can ask for, really.
You know what's weird, though, is in sports fandom, people seem to have no problem telling athletes to their face that they suck. I mean, I've seen it happen many times.
You mean during a game or just
afterwards? If they see, I've gone to a bunch of Red Sox games because I live. Well, I don't live near Boston. But I live in Massachusetts, and after the games, the people will wait outside for the baseball players to leave in their cars or to walk out of the locker room, and they will yell at individual players, call them out by name, and tell them how much they suck and tell them like what mistakes they made in the game, and that's a regular occurrence.
Yeah, but I would ascribe that to two things. One is that If you're insulting the players from the team that just played your team, you know, if they're the enemy, then you're kind of, the excuse is that you're showing loyalty to your team by
going after the home team. They're criticizing the Red Sox players.
Okay, that's the other part, which is that, you know, the fans, you know, when the fans are disappointed by their own team, they'll tend to go after him. Like, I love you and you sucked, you know?
Yeah.
They get that, they have that indignation that, you know, they invest so much into their favorite team that when their favorite team lets them down, they have just this emotional reaction. And, you know, God help us if it ever gets that way in comics. Can you imagine?
That's kind of how it is on the internet, is that they have that emotional reaction to Superman or to Batman. And so when a creator does something that they disagree with, they have that visceral response. But it doesn't transfer over to the personal interactions. I haven't seen it at any conventions the way it does in the sort of world of sports, which is good because that would be crazy.
Well, it would be because comic book characters are fictional, Tim, and you know, sports figures are real people.
They're fictional, you say?
They are. They are. I hate to break it to you, but
wow,
they don't
exist.
Wow,
the world is in shatters now.
I know.
I don't know. I read some Grant Morrison comic where that wasn't true at all, so I don't really agree with that.
So, getting back to comics, one thing I wondered, when you do stuff like The Last Defenders or Zodiac, you usually seem to write as if you have more plans for the characters. Is that on purpose, or is that just the way you naturally go for these miniseries that sometimes are just thrown out there never to return to?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to write miniseries as though I'm writing ongoing miniseries, or not ongoing series. And my philosophy of writing ongoing series is that, I mean, you know, I'm so over, and most people are, but some people are still out there trying to make it work. I'm so over decompression and stretching stories out over many issues. I mean, I want shit to be just jam packed, you know, as much shit on every page as you can get. And, so when it comes to miniseries, I have that same outlook, you know. I just want it to be bursting at the seams with whatever it is I can think of to put in there. Because, you know, not to sound, you know, old fashioned, but that's how they used to be. That's the comic books I grew up reading were like that. So I'm just trying to sort of replicate that feeling, not just for the reader, for myself too. I mean, when I went through my period of, you know, like sort of running with the pack and like things had to be arcs and all this kind of bullshit, I don't remember it ever feeling all that comfortable for me. I mean, I can do it. It's a lot easier to write in that decompressed style because you only have to have two ideas in a year, you know. But when I was writing that way and the times that I would write that way, it just didn't feel like I was writing comics in the way I'd imagined doing it when I was a kid, you know. And so I finally, you know, sort of pulled myself out of that way of thinking and just whatever gig that I had, I just started writing as though I was writing in that style, if that makes any sense. I mean, that's just how I wanted the comics to feel. And I still wanted to feel that way, you know. And it's just, I don't know if it's necessarily personal philosophy. I don't want to be part of the problem. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the easiest way to look at it. I don't want to be accused of something, of doing something that I don't like to see other people do. You know?
What I see with some of the writers who do the decompressed comics, or at least are perceived to be doing decompressed comics, is that a lot of readers who like those kind of comics because they feel like there's a stronger emotional connection. They feel like they can kind of get into the story and invest more emotionally. Whereas a comic that is hyper-compressed, obviously that's the other extreme, kind of pushes them away. And also readers who see comics that are playing too much with craft and are trying too many narrative tricks, they find that those kind of stories push them away. And obviously I happen to like those kind of stories. I mean, I'm more interested in the craft than the emotional impact. But how do you as a writer, who obviously seems to be interested in playing around with the conventions of narrative and playing with those narrative tricks, how do you balance that reader need to invest themselves emotionally into what's going on, you know, keeping them reading, but also, you know, making sure there's enough going on, yet not pushing them away?
Well, I don't necessarily believe that decompressed comics bring readers in more emotionally. I actually think they keep them at an arm's length, because when you're presenting a comic book story in a cinematic way, which I guess is a charitable way to sort of go with
sure.
decompression. When you're watching a movie, you're completely a spectator. I mean, unless the content of the movie itself really touches you on a personal level, mostly it's a passive experience. You're just watching the story play out, and, you know, hopefully you like it, or if you don't like it, whatever, but it's not an interactive experience, and it's really not meant to be one. Comics, to me, are an interactive experience. So to make them feel like movies actually, to me, pushes the reader away. It pushes me away as a reader. It's not giving me those spaces, even if they're, you know, minuscule, to kind of invest myself. But when something's really just, things are coming at you at a rapid fire pace, ideas and moments and, you know, character interactions or, you know, and characterization on the run, you really, as you're trying to keep up, you're also really investing a lot of your own ideas into it, you know. That's the thing that, you know, what Grant did really well as far back as JLA is that he would toss off these ideas and these concepts within the narrative that weren't really part of the main story he was telling, but they were so interesting that it just made you go, wow, I wonder what that story would be. And you make it up in your own head. I mean, you have your own ideas about it. And that's fantastic. That's real. That's a real interactive experience with a comic book. And so, not enough people do that, where you're just giving a reader so much information, or as much as you can possibly give to them, that that overload makes them think about stuff and sets them on their own sort of course in their own head. And that's when it's great. That's when comics are at their best, when it's really interactive, because that's what they were for me when I was a kid reading them. You know, they just set my imagination going. And not just in making me want to do them myself, but just as it's like audience participation, you know. When I was a kid and I would kind of draw my own comics, what I would do is, you know, an issue of the Avengers would come out, right? And you knew the next one was a month away. And if not longer, depending on when you can get your mom to drive you to the fucking store. So what I would do is, between the time I bought the issue that was out and the time the next one would come out, I would try to do my own version of the next issue and write it and draw it. And get, you know, and usually I'd only get like about, you know, 5, 6, 7 pages in before the next issue came out, and I would see how wrong I was. But that to me is like, comics should be doing that for people all the time. I mean, not necessarily making you want to do them, but in your mind, you're already thinking about your own version of what the next story is, or what's behind the moments that you're seeing on the page, you know? And if I can do that for me as I'm writing the stuff, I feel like maybe I can do it for the readers, you know? Because, I mean, obviously, it's not completely, it's not completely conscious. I'm trying to turn myself on as I'm writing this stuff, too. So I feel like if I'm doing it for me on that level, then maybe I'm doing it, you know, for other people. That's the hope, anyway.
Was that part of the reason why, like, Zodiac was a no-name, new character, kind of like a let readers figure out how he came to be Zodiac, per se, type of thing?
Yeah, because I think some of the reactions I saw, people did wonder that. Who is he? And it's not, and I know that somebody asking who is he is not just, they're not just asking the question. They're thinking about it. They're thinking about their own ideas about who he is, or who he might be, or how he connects to the Marvel Universe, or whatever. And that's when it's really working. You know, that's when it's really cooking, that relationship between the work and the reader. And when that relationship is, you know, not happening, then, you know, what are we doing here? Why are we reading it? Or why are we creating it, you know?
So one of the things that I wanted to kind of follow up on related to that idea of audience is, and Chad and I have kind of talked about this from a journalist or critic perspective, where when we're writing something and we might invest a ton of time doing research and writing this extensive analysis, and then you get like no hits on the column or no hits on the blog and like one comment, and yet you just churn something out really quickly that's like a top 10 list, and that thing gets a million comments and everybody clicks on it and it's really popular. How does that kind of thing affect a comic book writer when maybe you spend a lot of time writing something that's really personal and important and it doesn't sell that well, but then something else that's just a work for hire situation that you just, you know, you might obviously put yourself into, but not to the same extent, sells a lot better. How does that kind of shape what you end up doing?
Well, I'll go you one better. I think that highest selling work isn't even close to being what I consider the work that I'm proudest of, or if I can, you know, my best work or whatever, if I can even go there. And that would, you know, I mean, and that's, you know, the X-Men run sold huge, you know, way more than, you know, numbers that, you know, the X-Men would kill for now, you know. But I just felt like, oh my God, you know, this high profile gig and I'm not really clicking with it my own self. So I know that readers aren't clicking with it, you know. And that once I sort of went through that experience, and then, you know, doing something like Kafka and Wildcats and The Intimates and, you know, other my own creator owned stuff that I really felt that I'd wasn't not only invested in, but that I'd reached some new place in my own work, and it doesn't sell as well. That's really when I understood the game, really, for myself, which was like, it doesn't really matter, you know, sales and all that kind of stuff. Just try to do what you want to do and treat all gigs equally in terms of what you might be able to get out of it, you know. Don't think about sales. And I don't mean don't think about it selling a lot. Don't worry about it not selling anything, you know. It's still a huge accomplishment to fans. And if one person that you don't know buys it and reads it and likes it, that's, I'm still fairly blown away by that whole thing, you know. I mean, I'm just, you know, it's still shocking that, you know, anyone that doesn't know me, and even people who know me don't buy my fucking books, you know. But the people who don't know me would buy anything that I wrote and read it and like it, or take the time to, you know, have any opinion on it at all, is pretty intense when you think about it. Because there's no reason for it, you know. It doesn't really make any sense. There's many other things that people could occupy their time with than, you know, any piece of entertainment, that if people are willing to invest themselves in it and really, you know, put some time into it, think about it. I mean, that blows me away. So the least I could do is really put everything that I fucking have into these things, you know. So that, I mean, I would hate to think that anyone would think that I just dashed something off. And believe me, I have in my career. But I feel like they're fewer and further between now than they've ever been. So, I mean, I don't know. It helps me sleep at night to some degree. I don't know.
Well, I can just understand the impulse. And obviously, I'm not accusing you or anything. And I wouldn't expect you to name any names. But maybe you have seen this happen where if you're getting mainstream work and maybe you're under contract with a company or you're getting mainstream work regularly, I could see the impulse. And it wouldn't necessarily be a cynical impulse to, you know, quote unquote, give the fans what they want. Like the stuff that you're really investing yourself into and you're really trying something different, it launches and sells 10,000 copies of an issue. And yet you just, you know, for whatever reason, rush to get this other script out. And that's the thing that's really popular. You're like, well, you know, what's the incentive? I could see how creators could fall into that trap. I mean, I could see that it would be a difficult, it ultimately would be whether or not you really thought that it was about creating something artistic that you know, that you could connect with or that you could sleep at night because you created it. But I could see that impulse. I could see creators just kind of falling into that trap of, and it, like Jeff Loeb, for example, not to pick on Jeff Loeb, but Jeff Loeb clearly has stated his measure of success is how well something sells. And yeah, he's intentionally giving fans what he thinks they want because it will sell better. I mean, that's his stated goal.
But the difference is, I mean, for me, I'm not that kind of reader. And so I can only judge how I would react to something as a reader, as a fan, or whatever. So I was never that guy that was like, you know, cater to me, you know, do what I want with these characters as a fan. I was never that way.
Right.
I mean, aside from, you know, being 8 years old and going, why isn't Hawkeye on the Avengers, man? You know, aside from those things, I never felt like, you know, Mike Barron owed it to me to write the Nexus story that I want to see. I want his Nexus, you know?
Yeah.
I invest enough in creators to just give me what you think is, you know, give me what you want to put out there in the world. And if that's dashing it off, then I'll take it if that's what you're going to put out there.
Why Kadeem Hardison in Godland?
Well, the real question is, why not Kadeem Hardison?
Because that made me laugh so much when he revealed that.
He hasn't gotten his due, I don't think, as an actor or as a figure in pop culture. And we haven't seen the last of Kadeem in Godland, you know.
What's going on with Godland? I know you mentioned a while ago that this would be, we're hitting the point where the series seems to be ending soon, maybe. Do you have an end point in mind yet?
I do. I was just emailing Scioli about this. We're getting into the last run of issues, and believe it or not, there's actual pressure for them to be good. There's actual pressure for them to pay off in all the ways that the series seems to be headed for. You know, I mean, I know I know where it's got to get to, but to go from, like we were saying earlier, this improvisational style of writing to, I have to kind of get out of that mode now and really think about how this thing's going to wrap up. And that is, I'll admit, it's slightly intimidating. You know, it's a big series. It's got big ideas. We're really swinging for the fences, you know, with, in each issue, we're just trying to get it bigger and bigger and bigger. It's, you know, it's become more difficult to write because you want to kind of put a cap on it that is satisfying and is true to what you've done for the previous, you know, 30 odd issues. And it's not necessarily, it's not stage fright. It's just, I'm really taking some time in figuring out what the hell it's got to be, you know? And it's, you know, and again, it's one of those things. I mean, I feel a bit pretentious talking like this because it's just a comic book, but, it has for me personally fulfilled a lot of things that I set out to do as a writer and as a comic book creator. So I don't want to do it a disservice by, you know, I don't want to miss the shot at the end, you know? I mean, I think that American writers, comics, they brick the ending so much. We're terrible at endings. I don't even want to limit it to American writers. I think comic book writers in general always tend to fluff the endings. You know, even Watchmen, people complain about the ending. Mm. So there's pressure, you know, and I've had, you know, working on the work for hire side, I've certainly had a few, you know, endings yanked out from under me. So that adds to the pressure of, you know, I want to make sure it's right and make sure it works and it's got to satisfy me. And I might be the harshest judge of all because I could just go, well, something cosmic happens and, you know, just dash it, you know, just kind of pump it out and be done. But this is not something that, I just don't feel that way about this particular book, you know? So, you know, that's a long answer to an easy question, but that is what's going on with God Man.
Why do you think so many comic book writers have trouble with the endings? Is it because it's a serialized medium for a large part? Is it because of the collaborative process? Why do you think that is?
I think all of those things are exactly right. I think that, it's not as serialized as it used to be, basically because books get canceled left and right, you know?
Right.
And, you know, I mean, we're just not in the culture where a writer can come onto a book and sort of take it over from issue number, you know, 312 and just kind of go on from there and just be part of the larger narrative. But there's still that mindset, you know? And I just don't think, I mean, there's not a lot of training for this job. You know, it's kind of learn as you go. And it's just not something that, on the whole, we're very skilled at. And the funny thing is, even writers that come in from other mediums, they kind of tend to fluff the endings, too.
Yeah. You know?
Because maybe their view of comics is exactly what you said, Tim. They just seem never ending. So why worry about an ending? But I just don't think. I mean, I think we're in it now. We've got to start thinking about our endings more, you know. And anytime writers, you know, will say, "Well, like start with the ending and then work back from there," I call bullshit. You know, I just don't think it's often in, at least in terms of, you know, work for hire, more commercial comic books, it's just not part of the thinking. It's not part of the mindset going into it, you know?
And even if you did, even if you were able to do that as a way of creating your story structure, once you start filling in the issues with content and stuff happens, I mean, that's got to change where the story's headed. So
yeah,
ultimately you have to revise what your plan was anyway.
Yeah. I mean, with Godland, I have a sort of a general notion conceptually of what I want the last issue to be. But to get to that, I have to sort of wrap up all the balls that I've thrown up in the air, you know, and there's probably about 12 of them that I'm trying to keep in the air at this point. And I don't want to drop any of them. I want people who have stuck with the book from the beginning to feel like they got something out of it that was a total experience, not just kind of a half experience. You know, it's daunting to do something that even I feel personally like, wow, we finished it and it feels complete, as opposed to leaving something with a bunch of regrets, like, oh, I wish we'd done this, or I wish I'd thought of that, or I wish I'd done that. I'd rather just give it a little bit of time to breathe. I mean, it's not going to be too crazy. I mean, I have, you know, there's only four comics left that are going to come out. But I'm not in, I feel a little bit of pressure creatively, but I guess at this point, the schedule's so whacked that I'm not feeling too much pressure to pump those issues out in some timely manner, you know.
Right, but it's still not a lot of pages left to wrap up everything and to kind of get some thematic connection to everything. I mean, yeah, it's not a lot of time.
Yeah. I mean, the last two issues will be double-sized, and even starting with 34, which is the next one that will come out on the stands, I think that one we went to, I think, 26 pages, so they're sort of getting bigger as they go along. But the last issue in the finale will be, will probably be as close to double-sized as you can imagine. I mean, you know, these days double-sized is, what, 30-something pages, but they might even be longer than that. It's one of the few times in my career where I'm the slow one, really, because Scioli is just, I just sort of light the fuse and his imagination goes, and he's just, you know, he just can pump it out, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm the one who's now going, okay, let me think about this for a minute. You know, I mean, if you look at 36 issues of something, there's the beginning where you're kind of setting things up, then there's this middle period where you're just kind of spinning things around and spinning plates and going on little tangents and coming up with, you know, wonky things that entertain you. Then there's the last act where you are left with the, you know, with the results of all that plate spinning. And where in issue, you know, 18, for instance, I was just coming up with things off the top of my head, not knowing where they were going to go, but knowing that they fit in the series. I mean, they weren't completely off the wall, although some things were. But now I'm in a position where, okay, shit, I got to actually make it all seem like a cohesive work. And I'll be the first to admit there are things in Godland that are not cohesive. And you could argue that's part of its charm, or you could say, well, that's a liability to a book like this. But it is what it is, and I'm just going to try you know, cap it off in the best way that I can. So
I was wondering, like, is you're kind of hinting at this and discussing this, but is this the first time you've had a long form narrative like this that you actually got to end it the way you want to?
Well, of my own creation, yes. But I think that there's been a couple of work for hire gigs. I mean, certainly I wanted it to end. I mean, I knew that last year was going to be my last year, so I sort of planned for it. I kind of even wrote the last issue of Superman that I did as though it was the last issue of that comic, you know. I staged some scene with Lois Lane and Superman where it was almost like they weren't married, or I don't know. I remember thinking, well, if I wrote it in a certain way, you could just pretend like they, you know, this was the end of their relationship or some weirdness like that, where I was really trying to put up some punctuation on what I'd done. And I think with Cable, even that far back, I was able to end it in a way that was emotionally satisfying. So I've had things where I was able to end it in a way that worked for me, maybe not for the readers, but for me, I was able to walk away from things without too many untold stories or too many regrets, but certainly nothing where I was as invested in this and people have sort of identified my career much more with this book than I anticipated they would. You know, I mean, it became a style of writing that sort of informed my other things that I did, and now it's kind of like, I don't know, in some ways it's what I do. So I, you know, the last thing I want to do is brick the shot, you know, right at the end. That would suck.
Well, I expect nothing but genius. I will accept nothing less.
Thanks a lot. That's right. Thanks a lot. That doesn't set me up for failure at all.
Nope.
Oh, well, I expect failure, so, you know.
Well, then you might be pleasantly surprised.
Well, that's my pessimistic worldview. Either I'm right or I'm pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I like that.
And that's a horrible way to live.
Exactly.
Is it ever frustrating to get taken up? Like, especially at this point in your career, do you find it especially frustrating to get taken off of books or to have like a miniseries like The Last Defenders of Zodiac get put out there and then never get to pick up on the threads you started, or do you just sort of accept that as part of the way things are now?
Yeah, I mean, a miniseries, you know how many issues you're going to get. So psychologically, you go into it going, this is what I have, and I'll make the most of it. I mean, I really haven't even danced with the notion of doing any, picking up any ongoings at the Marvel or DC. Those opportunities just, the ones that have been there, I haven't taken, and then the ones that I might be interested in just haven't, you know, weren't offered. So, I haven't really had to deal with that frustration in a while. Probably not since, I think the big one, I mean, Wildcats was the only one that felt like it really got, where we really got cut off at the knees. But everything else, I've at least had the chance. I've known when, like, the end of Kafka, I knew when that was coming. The end of The Intimates, I knew when that was coming. So I was able to kind of plan for them. And, you know, in, I don't think it's no secret that the ends of those two books got very meta, where I was actually able to sort of comment on the end of the book within the book itself. And that's probably a real kind of vanity move, but fuck it. It helps me, you know, it helps me cope with what's happening. So why not, you know?
I think the only one that came up recently that kind of stood out for me was Youngblood. That one seemed like you got sort of taken off midstream and didn't get really a chance to finish things up as you might have wanted.
Well, yeah, but I mean, look, it doesn't take, you don't have to really be some kind of comic industry analyst to know that every Youngblood relaunch has met with disaster. Alan Moore couldn't keep his dick hard for that one, so I went in with no illusions that it would probably just sort of end in a manner similar to how it did end. So I didn't go in too emotionally charged. I had fun on that book, but when it was over, I was just like, okay, you know. I did my time. Eight issues, getting that book out for eight issues, the quality that I thought it was a fairly high quality product. I mean, you could argue the merits of, you know, the content, but I think that it wasn't a cheap looking book. I mean, it held up. It was a quality piece of material. I mean, I thought the art was good. I thought it serviced those characters in an interesting way. I mean, it wasn't going to change, you know, how people looked at comics in general, but I'm not ashamed of that work at all. But having said that, I would never go into a situation like that going, oh my God, if I don't get to finish this story, you know, somebody hide the razor blades, you know. It's almost part and parcel that a Youngblood book would sort of fly off the rails at some point, don't you think?
Yeah, that's historically how it goes.
I know, I'm just part, it's just part of the tradition, really.
So how often, I mean, in those different circumstances, how do you find out when something is being canceled or not being continued? Is it sometimes you just don't find out, or is it sometimes you just get an email saying, hey, that's it, it's done? Just behind the scenes, how does that work?
It's just pretty much just like that. You get the email, you know, or the call, you know. And it's, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, I mean, they're telling you, I mean, the case of Youngblood, I was probably, eight issues came out, And I was writing 10. I was writing issue 10 when, cause I was just that far ahead. I was an issue and a half ahead of the artist. And, you know, they just say, well, this is what's going to happen. And you just go, okay. You know, what can you do? You know, it's the longer you're in the business and the more those kind of situations come up, you're prepared for it. I mean, you always know it's a possibility. And, you know, it's fine. Like I said, I had two reactions to Wildcats 3.0 going away, which was, see that book through in the way that I wanted to, but also I kind of a self-loathing that I actually let a work for hire gig affect me in that way. You know, I was so pissed. I was like, God damn it. Why am I upset about this? You know, I don't own these characters. This is the way it played out.
Yeah.
So, that's not to say I don't allow myself to get emotionally invested in my work, but if another opportunity came up that I thought might have the possibility of ending in that way, I definitely would think twice about entering into it, you know.
And I can also see that, part of what we were talking about earlier about people not really sticking the ending, and also just the way things sometimes fall apart structurally with longer arcs or ongoing series, might be because writers who write too far ahead would be punished, because you never know when your legs are going to get cut out from under you. You never know when you're going to have to all of a sudden change a plot because of some continuity thing. So there's no real incentive to be ahead and have that thing laid out in advance. You kind of have to work on the fly, or you have to work like, you know, one issue ahead at most, and that seems to contribute to some of these problems we're talking about.
I agree. I mean, that's kind of where that's partially where I adopted this, you know, hey, free will and attitude towards mainstream comics. I mean, just you're right. You can't depend on those things, and so unless you just are just going to walk away completely from the game, which I mean, I love it too much to ever say that. You then just got to adjust your own attitude towards it, you know? I mean, I used to be very, like, you know, I'd grouse if I had to be pulled into some... I mean, on Superman, it happened any number of times. You're pulled into some either line-wide event crossover thing or a contained within the Superman family of books event.
Right.
And I'd bitch and moan and stomp my feet. Like, ah, what the fuck is going on here? Now, I would just look at it as like just another challenge on the road of, you know, writing a corporate icon or a corporate, you know, franchise.
Sure.
And you take it on. You just go, all right, I'll write the shit out of this fucking crossover, you know, whatever. And you just kind of attack it as opposed to moaning about it, you know. I mean, there's no point in that. Those things are going to happen and you might as well roll with it. You know, otherwise you're just gonna make yourself miserable because that shit will happen. And I don't want to be miserable. I'm not a miserable guy.
It doesn't seem worth it. Nobody benefits.
No, and the reader doesn't benefit. I mean, I've written some angry comics. You know,
really.
And I think that what a reader probably comes away with from those comics is a feeling of anger. You know, not necessarily a feeling that they were entertained or, I mean, maybe people got a kick out of the last issue of The Intimates from just like, wow, look at this train wreck, you know, or look at this car crash happening right in front of my eyes. You know, the perverse, you know, glee that one feels when they're, you know, watching something just, you know, fly off the planet. But, you know, that wouldn't be my first instinct. Like, I want to make a reader feel the anger that I'm feeling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As a parent, you know, tantrums are not that fun to watch.
Exactly.
No.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to think at least my tantrums had some style and, you know, originality, but yeah, there was some tantrum behavior nonetheless, kind of not even buried in the text. I mean, at The Intimates, I had a forum to just kind of outright out and out say it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, with the info scrolls, I remember a few of those being like, this is just such a pain to write these little things sometimes.
Yeah. But I did it, I think I would get art back and just be like, this is terrible, and I would actually rewrite dialogue to reflect my disappointment in the art that I had been given. You know, I mean.
Yeah, I remember a couple pieces like that. Or even, I don't know if you did this on purpose, but there is one of the early issues of Wildcats where you're scripting over Scott Lobdell's plots. There's one piece of dialogue where one of the characters is just like, this is such a stupid, silly thing we're doing right now.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's, yeah, that's meta commentary at its finest right there.
Oh, yes. With Wildstorm officially ending this month, how weird is it to look back at that period or think that, like, I even look back at that period and think, like, wow, it was, like, you, Warren Ellis, and Alan Moore kind of doing, like, the big chunk of the work for a good 2-year period there. Is it weird to think of yourself in, like, that company or having a defining bit with that company?
I don't, well, no, because I don't think of myself in that company. And those guys did kind of, they did work, I mean, Warren Ellis especially did work at Wildstorm that influenced everybody, you know? I mean, just the authority influenced everything that came after it. And I kind of was in there doing little kind of cult books and, you know, and of course Alan Moore is Alan Moore. I mean, the things that he does is just on a bigger stage, you know, culturally, no matter what. I think that, you know, it's a shame that it just, that the place went to hell. And it did go to hell, otherwise the books would still be great, you know. There's nothing that, I mean, talk about meta. I mean, you can point to Wildstorm and go, I see where this thing went off the rails. You can look at specific books and see, you know. So it's a shame. But it's also very, it's a very Darwinistic approach, you know. I mean, if it ain't happening, you know, you don't need to be hanging around. You know, if you're done, you're done. And so it's probably for the best. That it just felt like diminishing returns. Every relaunch was like, oh, you know, again, really? And would just sell less and less and less. And, you know, I think the final numbers on Wildcats, I don't know, what does it sell, 5,000 copies or something? I mean, that's awful. That is awful. I mean, Wildcats 3.0 ended on numbers that I think that they would, you know, fillet farm animals to get now. You know what I mean? And, but, you know, what are you going to do? It's done, so, it's over, you know.
What was it about, I mean, that era of Wildstorm, though? Because for me, I was kind of unaware of that stuff all going on. Like, I was reading some of the Wildstorm stuff at that time during its sort of height. But I wasn't thinking of, wow, this is a major revolution or this is like a new era being ushered in. But really, it was. I mean, that was the kind of, and maybe it wasn't recognized by everybody at the time either, but that was the thing that kind of kicked off this renaissance in the past 10 years. So what was it like working at that time with that company? Was there something special about it or was it just a confluence of forces?
Well, it was exciting, but I mean, I was not, I didn't really pay any attention to Wildstorm. My taste had been formed way early on where I was going to follow creators and I was interested in creators over content, really. So Image Comics didn't interest me at all until, well, I'll say Wildstorm didn't interest me at all until James Robinson wrote Wildcats.
Yeah.
And here was, you know, I mean, not to put anybody else down, but here was, in my opinion, a real writer taking on these characters and showing that they had some value. And if you recall, James's first couple issues of Wildcats didn't even have the Wildcats in him.
Right.
He concentrated on some other side characters and kind of created a whole, you know, different cast, of like these, you know, these Black Razor kind of shield agent type of his approach to that material. And then Alan Moore came in and of course he then took the main Wildcats off the stage and came with a new team. It's, isn't that odd that the, you know, kind of quote-unquote real writers come in, and their instinct is to not write the main Wildstorm or the main Wildcats characters, but to bring in other characters so they could sink their teeth into. And I think I did the same thing with a couple of, you know, I brought in a couple new characters, and but the opportunity was there that here was a universe of superhero characters, fairly self-contained, especially when Wildstorm got bought. They were totally in their own universe. Now, you didn't have to worry about the other Image characters at all.
Right.
But yet, if you grew up in the 80s, and you were really a fan of these stylistic reinventions of existing characters, you know, Daredevil, Swamp Thing, the Teen Titans, Animal Man, and then, of course, you know, Batman, even, you know, in the mid-80s and things like that, this was an opportunity to do that kind of work, to take these characters that were seemed like a creative dead end and try to fucking make something out of them, you know? So for me, that was the opportunity, because I wasn't going to get it necessarily at Marvel, because, I mean, look, you can write Daredevil, but how many times has Daredevil been reinvented and sort of, you know, re-energized by, you know, I mean, it's happened many, many times, and you could say that for just about every character at Marvel and DC has gone through those things. But here was a kind of a blank slate. You could come in and really, and certainly we had the freedom to do it, because superheroes that aren't Marvel and DC superheroes, even the people who work at those companies know that they're not Marvel and DC superheroes. You know, if you know what I'm saying, I mean, they don't invest as much emotion, as much feeling, because they didn't grow up with them.
Right.
You know? So it was a great opportunity. Now, the downside of that is that we did all those things. I mean, by the time that myself and Mark Miller and Warren Ellis and Brubaker, by the time we'd run through that company, then Wildstorm was in the same position that Marvel and DC were in. We'd seen the reinventions. We'd seen the revitalizations of these characters. So much so that even goddamn Grant couldn't come in and really light the fuse anymore. I mean, can you imagine a superhero universe that's so dead that even Grant Morrison can't juice it up to the degree that he does with anything else he touches? That, to me, was, I mean, when that relaunch didn't work out, I was like, it's over. This thing is over. And that's pretty much what happened, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody could sense that, and then it just lingered on for a while, but I don't know anybody who was buying those comics after that point.
Brian Azzarello's Deathblow was interesting, I thought, but yeah.
Just laughter from the crowd.
Brian Azzarello, you know, I mean, you think 100 Bullets, you think of Loveless, you think of his real work that he's invested in, but then when you say Brian Azzarello's Deathblow, I mean, just it's hysterical.
Well, that's the thing. His take on the book was like dark black comedy that wasn't even meant to be taken seriously, too. Like, he couldn't even muster up enough energy to really take that too seriously.
Yeah, but I mean, I think what kept people away was not the Brian Azzarello part. It was the Deathblow part, you know? I mean, it just proves that it wasn't, those characters were not a canvas for good creators to come in and apply a different side of their craft or a different side of their creative personality. The characters were so dead they couldn't even appreciate what Azzarello was bringing to the table, because you just couldn't get past the fact that it's fucking Deathblow, you know?
So what you're saying is you killed the Wildcats?
Yes, like in a funeral pyre.
It was for the best.
It wasn't conscious, but I really, you know what? It was conscious, because to have an opportunity like that, you go in going, you know what? I'm going to write the fuck out of these Wildcats, so much so that no one will be able to follow me. And, you know, not for nothing. I mean, I don't think anybody was able to, you know? Because, I mean, the sales were just moderate, And certainly, you know, they dipped at the end, otherwise they wouldn't have canceled it. But we're, I don't know, fuck, we're at least 5 years, 6 years out. And the fact that anybody still talks about anything that has to do with Wildcats, it, you know, is amazing to me. I mean, you know, it just, I don't know if it deserves people still talking about it. Or, you know, why did they even keep trying to publish that book? I have no idea.
Because that's what you do in comics. You keep publishing things because they've been published before.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah, you're right. And that's called the law of diminishing returns.
Yeah. And then, look, they're, yeah, they're republishing. They're finally putting out a trade at the second year of version 3.0.
Do you, what? Say that again? What?
I said they're, and just to show, like, well, Wildstorm is dying, they're actually putting out a trade of the year, the second year, the uncollected year of version 3.0 for Wildcats.
Yeah, I don't understand that at all, why they're even doing that, you know. To me, that's like rubbing salt in the wound, you know. Well, I mean, why put that out when and not put out a Kafka trade? You know what I mean? I mean, at least Kafka ends. It's a complete work, you know. I don't get it.
I don't understand a lot of the policies around Wildstorm, because I'm on the DC comp list, and half the stuff DC sends are Wildstorm comics or trades. Really? I don't know why are they promoting the Wildstorm line at this point. I don't understand it at all.
Because they don't want that shit cluttering up their offices.
Here, go review this, because we don't want to hear. Yeah.
I'm glad that stuff is coming out, but it doesn't make any sense. I mean, why now? I mean, I just don't understand why now. I mean, they're not even. I would assume that the one commercial reason to put it out is to if Dustin's gotten more fans from working on Batman these past couple of years, that those fans might feed over. But I mean, first of all, his style is completely different, and also they're not really marketing it in that manner. They're just kind of putting it out there, you know.
And not even but also, that. I was going to say, how many issues of the second year did he even draw? Because I remember him kind of leaving at least, maybe not right when the first year ended, but pretty soon into the second year, maybe.
I think he did five issues. I might be wrong about that, but I think it was five, and then there was this guy whose name escapes me, and I feel like an asshole, who did like an issue and a half. Sean Phillips did an issue. Or a half an issue. I did a flashback, and then Duncan came in and did the last five, which I remember the reaction of people being like, "Oh no, it just turned into sort of like an action romp." But I actually really dig those issues. I thought Duncan did a great job. I'm glad that collection is coming out, just so maybe people will see those issues. And the Pascal Ferry issue. That's right. I forgot about that. He did an issue in there, which I also was pretty happy with. But that was like, you can see, I mean, I tend to, you know, I wear my interests on my sleeve, and I was perfectly willing to not abandon the corporate angle, but to put it aside, because at that time I thought, well, here's a story with, you know, Zealot and the Coda and all that shit, where I can really tell a real action-oriented story and push my own action chops in a certain direction that I hadn't done before. And that was just, and of course I didn't know that would be the last thing that the book would, you know, contain. But, I look back on those issues. I'm pretty happy with those things. I mean, at that Pascal Ferry issue, I thought for something that I went into it going, all right, this is going to be page 1 to page 22 action. I feel like it holds up pretty well, you know. Just on a purely craft level. I mean, yes, it might deviate from sort of the tone of the series, but from as a writer's exercise, I thought I pulled it off, you know. And that I don't always feel that way, so.
Well, one thing I can't understand about that collection though is they're not including the coup d'etat special you did. That seemed kind of, I wouldn't say essential to your run, but it had some... It was more of a Wildcats 3.0 issue than a tie-in to the coup d'etat authority taking over the government type thing. Like, it seemed very much about the ideas you were exploring in that series. It seems weird that they're not including that as part of the second year. The same way that they didn't ever trade the annual you did in Volume 2 that dealt with Warblade and stuff like that.
Right, right. Well, I think, I mean, the fact that the coup d'etat special is in, there's a trade of the coup d'etat stuff. I think there's a collection of that. And I think it sits better in that, where I'm actually kind of pissing all over the idea, you know, of coup d'etat, whatever, you know, other issues where it's like you're reading a story and suddenly it becomes the chapter where all the characters go, this is a fucking stupid idea, isn't it? Which I felt at the time. I mean, and I know Brubaker was sort of the spearhead of that thing, but I think history has proven that that by far was not his most affecting work. So I don't regret kind of pissing on him in public, or at least within that story.
I read Coup d'Etat, and I could not tell you what that was about at all. I have no memory of that.
It's about the authority takes over the world.
Well, the U.S. government, specifically.
Oh, okay. Even better. Even better.
Yeah, nobody after that seemed to know what to do with it. Brubaker tried for, like, two or three issues of his Authority 12-issue miniseries before he just, like, screw it, let's abandon that and just go do something else.
Well, because we're, I mean...
Yeah, where do you go from there?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, believe me, where I was going with Wildcats was somewhere way beyond that. But in a similar vein, this sort of, I mean, in a way, I kind of look at not finishing that run as a self-preservation tactic on Wildstorm's part, because what I was going to do would have really just taken it out of continuity. It would not have, I mean, I was just going to abandon the whole idea of a Wildstorm universe and just take the story where I thought it should go. What I felt were like logical conclusions to the things I'd set up. And that would have been way more radical than the coup d'etat stuff, you know? So, maybe it was a blessing in disguise. Who knows?
See, now I just want to ask you what to expand on those ideas, but I know you probably don't want to.
Yeah, don't make me cry. I don't want to get...
Okay.
Painful memories. But the thing is, I could tell you, I could just sit here and go... Well, this was going to happen, this was going to happen, but I really, that's not the comic, is it? I mean, that's just me kind of listing ideas. But ideas, those are a dime a dozen. The execution would have been the thing you'd want to see, you know, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Okay.
Like, it's the same thing I always wondered since you talked, when the Intimates launched, you talked about, at least later, that you'd pitched that and a follow-up to Kafka about The Warning. I always wondered what The Warning was, but I also knew that if you had ever just, like, described it, it wouldn't be as great as it might have been type of thing.
Yeah, it was pretty great, though. I will say that. But having said that, I will tell you this. A few ideas that were part of that pitch, really, have made it into another... creator-owned book that hasn't even been announced yet, or hasn't even, you know, we're working on it, but it hasn't been talked about yet. Not even in an underhanded, you know, buried in an interview somewhere kind of way. So I was excited enough about some of the stuff I came up with for that to hold on to it and carry on. I mean, I don't want to, don't get me started about, I mean, there's a script written for the what could we call it that's legally the continuation of Kafka at a different publisher. There's a script written, and I mean, it's literally like Automatic Kafka number 9 part 2, because that's what was going to get us into the next series. And I have house ads that Ash did, they sort of mocked up. We got really close. You know, and it was a real fuck it kind of project, because that would have, I really don't know if we were dancing on legal issues, but I have a feeling that we probably would have been. But at the time we were like, you know, let's do it anyway. And then it just kind of fizzled for whatever reason. I don't know.
Yeah. And then Ashley did something in that next issue, the first next issue project from Image that you had a thing with Bill Sienkiewicz with, where he did, like, what was it, Automated Yates at the end or something?
Yeah, that was kind of, I think that was a nod to what we had in mind, you know, or kind of what we were going to do, really. I mean, we were really going to try to dance that line of, like, letting people know that this is it. This is the continuation without legally being, you know, like totally exposed. But God, I mean, it was, I know we were dancing on the edge. And having written that first issue, I mean, I got a lot of shit out of my system just writing that script. And in retrospect, it's probably a really good idea that that thing did not see print. Because I mean, this was post Wildstorm. This was post any involvement I had in Wildstorm, but I was still sort of nursing the wounds that it was inflicted from the experience. And oh man, I mean, I was really working some shit out in that first issue. So it was beyond the pale. I mean, people would have thought I'd gone crazy, you know.
Wow.
I know you're intrigued, aren't you?
I'm so fucking intrigued. I can't even tell you.
But that's the whole thing. I mean, it's whether or not that thing ever saw print, and I think it's better that it didn't. I think I'm happy that I wrote it, because I do think that these things can be a vehicle for personal expression, even if you're just working out some anger, some psychological bullshit that probably no one wants to see. No one wants to read about, but sometimes you just feel compelled to do it. You just feel like, I have to do this. I have to get this out. And, you know, sort of career be damned, you know, and whether or not it's, you know, shit I've said in interviews. I actually think this one has been fairly tame compared to some of the interviews I've done.
Yeah, you can unleash. Go, feel free.
Well, no, I'm not really in the mood. And
right.
You know,
it's not, you're not feeling it.
No, it's not that. It's just, it's when I do a print interview and I'm able to really sort of, you know, you get emailed questions, and I mean, I can really think about what I'm going to say, and there's not one thing that I've ever said in an interview that was, you know, that I typed out, an email interview, that wasn't 100%, I knew exactly what I was saying and what the effect might be. And I knew why I was saying it, even if it looked like I was lobbing a grenade in the middle of my own career.
Right.
I mean, it's all conscious. I mean, I'm a writer, you know? I mean, I'm not just sort of dashing off questions that are supposed to represent my personal voice and not be completely in control of what the fuck I'm saying. I mean, I will never listen to this, I guarantee you, because I don't know what half the time, I have no idea about it. So to be confronted with it, I'm still coming to grips with the fact that this goddamn thing's going to be online, you know, and that other people will listen to it.
Right.
And listen to it later tonight, possibly.
Oh, Christ. Oh, my God. Well, anyway, but yeah, so, you know, I'm trying to be as thoughtful as I can. I could unleash, but I think it would end up being, it would come off more comedic.
Yeah.
Than passionate, so, you know, best not to go there.
There's probably also no immediate frustration in what's going on in your career right now. Anyway, I mean,
oh my God, no! What do I have to complain about?
Yeah, you're doing creator-owned stuff that you love.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Well, I'm also not. I'm excited to talk about something like Butcher Baker, but you know, it's not like, God, if I don't sell X amount of copies, I won't eat. You know. I mean, I'm thankfully, and God bless, over that hump. So now I can really, you know, that's the other thing. I mean, I'm whatever repercussions there are from talking about, you know, Wildstorm, for Christ's sake, which is a dead company. There's no repercussions that really I'm worried about, you know. But, in terms of the things I'm willing to talk about.
Did you ever see any...
You can go down to your local Target and you can see why. You know what I mean?
or turn on the TV.
There you go. That too, yeah.
Did you ever see any repercussions from that autopilot little short thing you did with Sean Phillips, the semi-autobiographical one? That was kind of talking candidly about your experiences writing Superman and X-Men and Wildcats.
Yeah, but I didn't think that anything in there was particularly inflammatory or insulting to anyone. I thought that was a fairly, you know, reasoned, you know, at the time, thoughtful meditation on, you know, what those gigs are, you know.
I mean, you wouldn't see any blowback, though.
Oh, that's true, but no, I didn't. I mean, that would also, that thing was buried in some Dark Horse anthology that nobody read, you know. And I found it particularly amusing that, if I recall, the book was called Reveal. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was the only motherfucker that revealed anything.
I don't think I read anything else in that, actually.
You didn't read? Wasn't there a Picasso, it was Picasso's comic strip or whatever? Yeah, I thought that was the hook of the whole thing, you know?
Maybe I read stuff, but nothing left an impression. I don't know. I can't remember, really.
I found the characters thin. Unless Picasso's going to do a run on Batman, I'm really not interested.
Well, let's make that happen, then.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that. Yeah.
So are you kind of at the point where you only do comics because you want to? That was something I kind of saw in the recent Art of Jim Starlin book, where he was talking about how he's got all this other stuff going on outside of comics, that he only basically does something when he feels like it, when he feels like he doesn't do it for the money, per se. He just does it because he wants to do more comics. Are you kind of at that point now, too?
I guess pretty much, you know. I mean, I certainly don't get paid for, you know, selling, you know, 6,000 copies of something at Image Comics, but, I mean, I don't want to... The problem with sort of putting that foot forward is that I don't ever want to come across as though I don't have as much, if not more, passion for the medium, because I do. When you sort of get those career aspects out of the way to a certain extent, either you become a dabbler, which I don't feel like a dabbler at all. I've got more comic book stuff on my plate than I've had in years. Or it can become your passion again, and you can follow those passions because you're not worried about career. You're not worried about playing nice politics within a company or whatever.
Well, yeah, that's more take it as.
Yeah, well, that's definitely the side I've fallen on, you know. And I probably, as more of these creator-owned things start rolling out, you know, I'll probably be out there pimping it more. I mean, you know, not for nothing. I mean, I would never do this kind of press for, you know, a run on, you know, Green Lantern or whatever. Just pick your corporate franchise. You know, I would never go out and talk like this about that stuff because I wouldn't have to. There's a whole corporate marketing force that's more than willing to talk for you. They just need your pull quotes and they're off to the races. But the fact that the work that I'm doing is much more personal means that I want to promote it in a more personal way. I mean, that's the whole Butcher Baker thing was really... Those teasers were performance art. They weren't really, I don't know how necessarily effective they were in promoting the book. I mean, I saw one guy online somewhere go, well, once they found out that it was me and that it was Huddleston and what the book was, they were like, well, I didn't really need the teasers. All I needed to know was that it was these guys and it was this idea and I'm on board. Once I saw that, I was like, well, then that means that I really just did the teaser campaign because I wanted to see it happen. You know, I wanted to see that thing, you know, I wanted to conceive of it, execute it, and watch it come to fruition, which is the same way I feel about the comics that I'm doing now, you know. So that's kind of where I stand. And my struggles are the fact that on the other side of things in my career, I guess you could call it the TV side, there's so much work that has to be done. We get so busy with that stuff that I don't want it to completely overtake. I mean, I don't want it to feel like, I have a TV day job and I do comics, you know, as they say, on the side. I really struggle with that being my life because I don't want it to feel like that. I always want the comics to be so central, and that if anything, being the, you know, producer and story editor on Spider-Man, or, you know, with, you know, the work we do on Ben 10 and Generator Rex, those are funding my comic book work, which is the primary thing. I mean, building that library of you know, original material, that's where my head is at, you know, as a creative person. And the rest of it is just like, well, these are now the work for hire gigs that I find myself doing, as anybody does, you know. I mean, in the case of Ben 10 and Generator Rex, there's the added bonus that we also are creators. But, you know, you sell those things to a network and you participate in their success, you know, on a back end kind of situation. But, you know, you can't be as invested in a TV show on a network as you can in your own comic book. You know, it's just, you'd be naive to think that you could have that level of involvement, you know. But as a creative person, I like that high level of involvement, and there's nothing better than comics to fulfill that need. I mean, the closest I came to that was directing the movie that I did a few years ago. But because that was done on such an independent scale, that could be just as immersive. But I mean, you know, doing a movie for a studio is just, you know, is just another work for hire gig. You know, you dash yourself against the rocks if you took it on as like, I will live and die by this, you know, directing the latest, you know, I don't know, if you're Michael Bay directing Transformers, you know, aside from the power you have in the industry, good God, how emotionally invested could you get? It's the fucking Transformers, you know? So that's kind of how I have to look at it now. I mean, the comic book, I'll live and die by my comic book work because it's, you know, I come up with it with the artist, we own it. It's, you know, it's the purest expression of myself in that medium. And luckily I can afford to be that passionate about it. You know, not everybody is that lucky. So, you know, it's a big deal. I don't take it lightly. But, you know, having said that, most of my day today was spent writing an outline for an episode of Spider-Man, you know, and that's a good time and it's really fun and I like Spider-Man, but it's, you know, that's I know that's paying for my ticket to the dance, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
how do those skills, those writing skills, kind of transfer back and forth? Have you learned anything by doing the TV stuff that informs your comic book work, or do you find that your comic book work informs your TV stuff? Are they completely separate?
Well, they're completely separate. They're related in the fact that they're sort of, the creator-owned stuff is a great pressure valve. To have work that you can do where you are your own boss, for lack of a better term, and to be completely fulfilled and complete, you can just express yourself with no limitations. It makes it so easy to then step over into the corporate side of things and work on Spider-Man, where you get a lot of notes, you get it's a lot of levels of approval. And you can then enjoy those gigs. You don't feel frustrated by those gigs because of those parameters. You feel like, okay, I'm going to work on Spider-Man and I know I'm going to have to do notes and revisions, and it's not going to be the purest expression of my creative whatever. But that's really easy to swallow when I can just turn around and go, yeah, but, you know, Butcher Baker is exactly the way I want it to be. And not just in the writing, from the marketing to, you know, every ounce of it is personal expression. That is that is the perfect balance. You know, I mean, if I was writing corporate work for hire comics, there wouldn't be that balance, because even in corporate work for hire, there is room for personal expression there. But in TV, boy, you're really serving a lot of masters, you know, from your, you know, from the executives to, you know, S&P. I mean, all kinds of levels you have to go through. So I find that I've really struck a nice balance between something that is very monitored and something that has absolutely no one's monitoring my comic book work, you know, clearly. And when Butcher Baker comes out, that will be very apparent that there are no restraints or restrictions whatsoever. It's that shit's out there, man.
So there will be no from one of the creators of Ben 10 on the cover or anything like that?
Well, I'd like to do that just as a gag. I mean, I find that insanely interesting. But
that way my kids can read it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. Keep your kids far away from Butcher Baker. I mean, it is designed to poison young minds.
Did you actually want to talk a bit about Butcher Baker? Because we haven't really touched
on it. We kind of glossed over it at the beginning.
Beyond, like, the teaser images, we haven't really talked about the comic at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, what do you want to know?
What's it about? Let's start with something, quote-unquote, easy like that. What is Butcher Baker, the Righteous Maker, about?
It's about an all-American hero who is kind of on the back nine of his career, and he is called back for one more mission, sort of tying up some loose ends in his career, and he takes the gig. He's going to do the gig. Unfortunately, one of the sort of underlying themes of the series is what does it mean to be a superhero that's past your prime? And is it possible to be past your prime? I mean, and it's sort of like the anti-Dark Knight in the sense that there are more limitations, the character kind of goes through a lot of shit because he's not as smooth as he used to be. And he's not as polished as he used to be, and his age is showing. And that's kind of the deeper part of this particular series. And of course, on top of that, there's a lot of sex, a lot of violence, a lot of there's definitely a lot of cheapness to it, if you want to call it that. I mean, there's a lot of cheap gimmicks to it, which they're not cheap to me because they're just part of what I like style-wise. I mean, you see in the teasers, I don't know if you guys saw the preview pages that came out after the book was announced. I mean, it gets right into it. I mean, the guys at fucking Plato's Retreat, banging a bunch of chicks, and that's tame compared to what happens later. So it doesn't hold back, but I kind of wanted the juxtaposition of that kind of sordid, over-the-top, shock-value comic book mixed with something that's a little bit deeper and, speaks more to, the human condition in some way. I mean, I like that to try to serve both masters equally, not shortchange one or the other, not hold back on the shock value because you want the deeper things to breathe more. And on the other hand, not be so shocking that, you don't get those other themes. And to be quite honest, I don't know 100% if the balance is there. I mean, people can read it and be the judge, but going into it, that's what I was trying to, that for me was the hook of the series in writing it,
It sounds to me, and I could be wrong here, and it's going back to previous work, but it sounds like it kind of is in line with Wildcats and Automatic Kafka, because those seem to be kind of books about also, like, what happens kind of after. Like, in Wildcats, it was what happens to these warriors after the war is over. Kafka was kind of about what happens to comic book characters after the creators leave. Like, what happens after the series ends, almost, kind of thing.
So yeah, I mean, yeah, I would agree because one of my tropes is post anything is interesting to me, and it's a way I think personally it's a way to work out some things that we all end up dealing with. Where at some point, and it hopefully it'll be on our deathbeds, but at some point you are confronted with the notion that, at least in certain areas, your quote-unquote best days might be behind you. You know, whether it's, you know, just physically as we get older, you know, and get fucking elderly. At some point, I mean, you know, somebody who's 70 years old, unless they're some kind of fucking triathlete, has to confront that they, you know, can't run around the block as fast as they used to, you know. It's coming for all of us. And I don't know. I mean, sometimes I tend to, you know, in my work, I tend to try to confront these things because I know that they're coming for me. And on some level, I want to be ready for it. So if I can work it out in a fiction setting, then maybe, you know, when that day comes for me, I'll be more psychologically prepared. Now, having said that, it might be just the opposite, where I get to, I hit 75 and it's like, it's worse than I thought. And then, you know, I just, you know, can't handle it. But, you know, at that point, I'll really get on the drugs. I'm saving heroin for when I'm in my 80s. Because if you're going to be a heroin addict, that's the time to do it, you know.
I think that's a good call. I mean, that's the healthy way to look at it.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, what is, you know, creative work if it's not working out, you know, your own, the things that swirl around in your head, you know? I mean, let's bring them out and confront them. And if, you know, and in comics, you can do it in what's hopefully an entertaining way. I mean, I'm not trying to hit anybody over the head with anything. But I feel like I can't be the only motherfucker on the planet who has these thoughts and has these, things that they, you know, they struggle with, or things that you want to confront, or things that, you know, are sort of the dark clouds that are over everybody's head. I mean, I just don't believe that I'm the only one that has these particular ones. So, sort of my ideal audience, I guess, are people who have those same dark thoughts churning around, you know, or feel the same, you know, kind of demons nipping at their heels, you know. I mean, I don't know. I would hope that I'm not the only one. God damn.
So if that's what the point of the series is, why use the sci-fi superhero kind of tropes to get there?
Because that's part of my DNA too. I mean, that's the kind of shit that I grew up on. And as a craftsman, I like exploring those genre tropes and you do your spin on them, you know. I mean, the whole idea of an all-American sort of patriotically themed superhero, you're walking in the footsteps of Captain America. I mean, that's the original one, and anything that comes after is going to be a play on that character to some degree. And this one's no different. I'm not hiding that fact. But then it becomes, well, what can I do with that type of character that, first of all, you could never do with Captain America, and second, may have not been done before. I mean, I am interested in looking for the originality within maybe time-honored genre elements. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me as a writer. I mean, otherwise, if I was just interested in fucking exploring the human conditions, I'd be writing novels and really no one would be reading. You know, I'd really have no audience at all. They'd just be, you know, navel-gazing exercises as opposed to trying to infuse genre with something deeper, you know, which I mean, I feel like that's a worthwhile endeavor, you know, to entertain and maybe inform. I mean, it's not trying to be a fucking after school special, but it's trying to acknowledge a shared humanity. You know what I mean? Well, that's fucking deep, isn't it?
Yeah, but then, I mean, I totally get what you're saying, because that's what excites me about the superhero genre, is that it can go to this deeper level, but it uses these symbolic characters to get there. And I know that a lot of people, I mean, even some critics, are dismissive of superheroes right off the bat. Oh, I mean, less the newer critics, but there's certainly a breed of critics, specifically kind of the comics journal type of critics, who dismiss superheroes, just without even worrying about any of the details of an individual comic because they are superheroes. And for me, yeah, I could read a novel about these same themes, but it's the genre playfulness combined with those themes that excites me as a reader.
Well, I think that, you know, critics of superheroes are gonna just go to the time-worn, you know, the old chestnut of, look, it's power fantasy wish fulfillment.
Right.
You know, it's something that children think about. But, you know, I think that superheroes have a capability of providing emotional wish fulfillment, you know, and that has a lot more to do with the fact that I think the median age of superhero reader is, you know, a lot older than anyone really wants to admit,
yeah.
You know? And older readers are going to gravitate more towards something that has more of an emotional resonance. The trick is, not to sacrifice that, the fun aspects, that power fantasy wish fulfillment, that still has to be there, which is why, you know, Butcher Baker will, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, he'll fuck a lot of chicks in this book. You know? But at the same time, as a character, he's also struggling with, you know, where is he in his life at this point? What does it all mean? And he's struggling with the bigger questions. But those two things can coexist. I mean, they have to. Otherwise, I mean, it's like that's the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that critics of those type of books, they resent the spoonful of sugar because it's like, you know, they don't want to have to deal with that aspect of it as well. But then, you know, why bother criticizing superhero comics? I mean, you're not going to change what they are.
Right, that's what they are. And to me, I mean, there was I think it was the very first column I wrote for CBR was just that idea that the superhero comics are part of this much larger romantic tradition that was the dominant form of storytelling and still is in movies for so many years, for centuries. And it's only in the past 40, 50 years that, and maybe a little longer, but 40, 50 years that to be serious, you had to be realistic and you had to have this very narrow confine of quasi-realism to be considered worthy of critical study or, you know, your themes matter. And that's just not the tradition of storytelling at all in the larger
sense. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense because basically what you're doing there is you're discounting allegory.
Yeah.
You're dismissing allegory as part of a critical process when you're looking at a work. And man, allegories can be an important, potent piece of something, you know? I mean, so, you know, whatever. If that's how they feel, then that's fine. They certainly won't be reading Butcher Baker, so why work?
And they'll be missing out.
Probably not. But, you know, I'll be missing out on their critique of it, I guess.
You might get it anyway, because they might not read it and still criticize it. That happens.
Well, that's fine. I got to say, not so much with my own work, but I really just think that right now the level of writing, I've said this in an interview, I don't know if it's come out yet, I did an interview with Tom Spurgeon that's fairly lengthy. I think he's saving it for the holiday shit, but the level of writing out there on the sort of, I get not, it's not even a journalistic side, but I don't want to just dismiss it as just sort of blogism because it's deeper than that. It's kind of critical writing about comics on the internet is such a high standard right now. I feel like it's pretty amazing. I mean, it finally came around to feeling like how I felt when I was reading, you know, the Comics Journal in, you know, 1985 or whatever, where real thoughtful writing is going on when it comes to, you know, I don't want to say just superhero books, but genre work. You know what I mean?
Right.
And who's that guy that does that Death to the Universe? What's that?
Matt Seneca?
Yeah. I know he's just a young guy, but, I mean, man, he's entertaining.
Yeah, he's great. And he didn't even go to high school.
Jesus Christ.
He's like 21 years old. And instead of going to high school, he managed this comic book shop as a high school age student and just read everything. including, you know, the foreign stuff and the alternative stuff. Yeah, he's super sharp.
There's more guys like that. I mean, it's just that who's the guy? I don't know names, but there's a guy who does a blog called Supervillain.
Yeah, Sean Witzke.
Yeah, that stuff is great too. Even when he talks about more things than comics, but I think that guy's great, and I think, you know, it's gotten to that level where I feel like, and you guys do it too, you know, on CBR and stuff. I feel like the writing about comics has gotten to a level where there's not enough material for you guys to write about that's worthy of the thought that gets put into it, you know? So, this sounds terrible, but part of my feeling is that if anything, I want to provide material that is at least worthy of discussion. You know what I mean? And whether it's just to blast it to pieces or not, I mean, at least it's something that it could be talked about. And, you know, because I just don't think, I don't want to see, you know, you guys waste your time writing about, you know, some fucking C-level DC comic where where the blogosphere is putting more thought into it than obviously the guys making the comic ever did, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, that's one of the reasons that I stopped doing the regular reviews, was because I was just getting burned out on that stuff, and I said, well, if I'm just going to do my column, then I can focus on whatever, and if it's not something recent, then I can dig back into the past, because this weekly stuff is just, like, it's all the same.
Right.
Meanwhile, I churn them out regularly anyways.
Living the dream.
It is living the dream. It's nice. It pays for all my comics. Not to sound too cynical.
I don't want to sound like, I don't know how I'm even coming across talking about this stuff, but I mean, it has gotten to that point where I tend to like reading about comics more than I like reading the comics themselves. I mean, I'll read, you know, that guy, what's his name? Matt's take on, what was it, Deadpool Max? He was just raving about it. Well, Lapham and Kyle Baker, those guys are fantastic. But I'm just not going to read Deadpool Max. But I'll read about it, you know, for hours I'd read about it. You know what I mean? It's kind of gotten to that point for me. And that's not to say that, I mean, and he's saying it's a great comic, but I'm still not going to read it. I mean, I just only have so many hours in the day. But I'd just rather read about it. It's sort of like, I feel like I've sort of seen it all with comics. And so, to read somebody else's perspective and they're really into it, that's almost as good as reading the comic, if not better for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I feel the same way about poetry, for example. Like, I teach poetry, but I'm not a guy who's going to crack open a poetry book ever. But I love reading really good critical pieces about poetry because it gets into what makes it work and why it works. And I like that side of it. And so, yeah, I can totally appreciate that. Obviously, I try to write that kind of thing about comics too.
Yeah. And that, I mean, I think that's a valid, influence on a writer of fiction is to, Tarantino went on and on about how Pauline Kael's writing influenced his filmmaking. So it's completely valid for, you know, critical writing to influence creative writing, you know. I don't necessarily think it should be such an immediate feedback loop, but I do know that things that I read in the Comics Journal or what have you, or interviews with creators when I was growing up, had just as much influence on me as the comics did. You know what I mean? And I don't want to, I'm actually almost, some of that stuff means more to me now than the actual comics, because the comics can sometimes become dated or just they're time capsules. But the sentiments that are behind them or the sentiments of the critics that wrote about them, those tend to end up being more timeless, you know? I don't know. That's just kind of how I look at it. I don't know if you guys feel that way, but...
No, I definitely see what you mean. I mean, like, I love Warren Ellis's comic book writing, but I still think that if you put all his comics on one pile and all of his writing about comics on another pile, I'd probably choose the writing about comics. I find that somehow means more to me the way you're talking about kind of thing.
Yeah, because if you've read enough comics in your life, and I'm sure between the three of us, we've read them all, that somebody writing about them, even if it's a comic book you haven't read, the comic that they're writing about, you'll have a better version of that comic in your head than could ever be in reality, you know? And as someone who makes comics, that's always the trick. I mean, going into something like Butcher Baker, I had a lot of ideas and a lot of thoughts about what I wanted to do, and they're, you know, grand as fuck. I'm like, you know, being real grandiose in my thinking. So then the trick is, when I'm actually writing the thing, how can I make sure that that feeling, even if I don't even get close to what I was thinking it would be in my head, how can I at least infuse some of that passion and some of that feeling into the final product, you know? Because if I can get it in there and somehow convey it, then maybe the reader will get it and it'll be conveyed to them. And that's the whole trick right there in a nutshell. It's not, you know, I mean, it's not about fucking, I mean, even at with the work for hire stuff, it's not about continuity or making sure that this works or this connects or that this piece fits or, you know, it's about conveying a feeling. It's about conveying enthusiasm. I mean, as much as, you know, people sort of poured over Grant's Batman, and like, it became this game on the internet about finding the bits of continuity he was referencing. If Grant's enthusiasm for that material wasn't coming through, people wouldn't give a fuck about those continuity bits.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was the fact that Grant was excited about it and inviting the reader to go out and do their research. I mean, talk about an interactive experience. That was amazing. And you know, and that shit just doesn't happen enough, you know, not nearly enough. So I think that the critical writing that's happening right now is bringing more to the table than the books are. You know, if you want to look at it as a dialogue, that the critical writing is bringing more to the table. I don't know what the fuck Bendis was on about whenever, like a couple months ago. That was insane. He was just not looking in the right places, clearly.
Yeah, that's what we said.
And he seemed to be talking more about quote-unquote journalism, not criticism, even.
But, but fuck, what journalism in comics, you know? So-and-so is promoted, or so-and-so is fired, and
yeah,
or so-and-so is taking this gig on. I mean, that's the extent of journalism in comics. I mean, you know, I don't think... I mean, creators have their own platform. They don't need investigative reporting to expose some weirdness that, you know, I mean, when the Dabble Brothers don't pay, the creators come out and talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
We don't need fucking Woodward and Bernstein out there, you know, digging for dirt. You know what I mean? So I don't know what that means, journalism and comics. I mean, it's critical writing that means anything, you know? That's the dialogue that we need to have. Again, that's not to say that it's, you know, we're not writing for critics, obviously, but that is, it's a worthy discussion. It's a worthy game of ping pong that is sort of, it's outside of the audience appreciation, but I do think it's part of the culture, because I think that if you want to put us in three camps, there's the creators, there's the critics, and then there's the audience. The audience can enjoy that back and forth as well, you know. They can enjoy, I mean, there's probably somebody out there who either read Deadpool Max and then read the guy's, you know, writing about it, or they read his writing and then went out and bought the damn thing, you know. So that, it's like something that's, you know, the ping pong is happening in all kinds of directions, you know.
Do you ever feel like putting on a critical hat at some point?
Fuck no. I did my time, you know, writing columns and doing sort of like, it wasn't critical writing, but it was extracurricular writing about comics and about the industry and about the culture. And I got my fill. You know what I mean? I did it enough. It got me in plenty of trouble. It stirred things up a little bit, and I'm happy to be done with that, you know?
Did you find that doing that, and I'm thinking of the Basement Tapes with Matt Fraction, for example, where you guys were kind of bouncing ideas off each other, or you were just kind of discussing what was going on, or some techniques that some creator used. I mean, I remember you discussing that that Death Ray issue of 8-Ball.
Yeah.
Do you think that having that discussion and articulating those things and bouncing ideas off each other was an important part of your creative process during that time?
I think so, because that was the outlet to have that discussion. Now I just have it with other, you know, I just have it with friends and other writers and what have you. But at the time, I, you know, it was a way to just get those things out of my own head. And why I felt the need to do it in a public forum, I can't explain. But you know, there it is. It's there for public dissemination. Of course, I ended up using it as, you know, a way to strike back at those who'd wronged me, and, you know, just like everybody else does. So God help me.
So I got all my Dreadstar issues out. I'm going to start reading them this weekend.
Awesome.
I'm like a couple, I'm 2 weeks behind you, though, so I got to catch up.
Once Starlin stops drawing it, who gives a fuck?
What's his last issue?
The last issue he writes and draws is 31. So that's how it worked out well for December, where it's 31 issues, 31 days.
Nice.
What are we talking about here?
We're talking about Starlin's Dreadstar, because Chad's doing Dreadstar December, where he's writing about every issue of Dreadstar that Starlin writes and draws.
And conveniently it works out as 31 issues he did that, except for one artist villain somewhere in the middle, and then 31 days of December. So it actually worked out pretty well.
Once you get past that, the amount of issues that are in the first Dynamite collection, I tuned out even back in the day. He kind of got less cosmic to me, you know?
Well, the stuff that's reprinted in that Dreadstar at the beginning, or the stuff from the Epic Illustrated, like, that stuff is just, that's some deep cosmic hippie stuff that doesn't have any real story to it.
Yeah, but then when the regular series began, it got a little more, it just got more pedestrian, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of did, especially focusing on the whole war between the two sides and trying to end it, except it sort of just became about Dreadstar versus the Lord High Papal.
I think that the reason, too, that series, I mean, it certainly lasted long enough, but the reason it's not acknowledged maybe as much as, I don't know if it should be, although it sounds like you're doing it right now, but that Dreadstar, just the design of Dreadstar, with that, he wore that hoodie and he had that weird axe that made it turn into a sword, those were not the most indelible designs to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, then he got a, I think coming up soon, in issue 12 or 13 or something like that, he gets more of the superhero-looking costume.
Oh, yeah, which is even worse.
It's a bad design. I mean, I was looking at it today, and he's got, like, really tight cargo pants on, and he's got his belt, and he's got that blonde goatee. Looks like a Mike Grell character. Yeah.
Even in the comic, though, he's even kind of like, this new costume sucks, and everybody else is kind of like, no, it looks good, it looks good. And you almost get the sense that was Starling, when, like, this sucks, and all the editors and stuff like that were saying, no, this is what you need, this is what you need.
I don't think writers would ever put in dialogue that makes fun of their own story. I don't think that would happen.
Oh, my God. I can't imagine.
No, who would do that?
You know, I was thinking about, while I was having a fucking horse piss in there, I was thinking about the, I have done a bit more journalism than I remembered. I took over Newsarama for a week and did, like, the guest editor thing.
Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
I interviewed David Michelini. I interviewed Christopher Priest. I interviewed Mike Barron. I interviewed a couple other people. And then I also did an interview with Walt Simonson in, like, I think, like, the third or fourth issue of Back Issue Magazine, which I love that goddamn magazine, man. But and those, that was kind of fun, because those were, like, legitimate, you know, heroes. And, you know, I mean, Simon's certainly unsung, but I thought Michelini is way underrated, you know. And I think Priest is way underrated. So it was kind of fun to wax those guys' cars in public, you know.
Yeah, so we have no way to follow. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I don't know. That was called an aside, folks.
No, I know what you mean. Writing for Back Issue magazines, where I've written like four or five articles for those guys, and it's fun to go back and just kind of get interviews with the creators from the 80s and see their side of things. I just did, I think it's coming out this winter, I did a big article on Power Man and Iron Fist. and I got to talk pretty extensively with Joe Duffy. And at first she was talking about the politics of Marvel being very different than what happened after Marvel became like much more corporate. And it was just kind of a small little intimate family at that time in the early 80s. But once she started actually talking about her experiences on Power Man and Iron Fist, she started saying, well, no, kind of, you know, there were always problems. And she got in some details about what was going on behind the scenes that I hadn't realized.
I think that's out. That's been out for it's the newest one. It's the one with, it's not the newest one, I've read that.
Oh, you
that
did?
Came out already. Yeah.
It's the one about, I think, superhero duos or teams.
Yeah.
That's out?
Yeah, it's the most recent one. It just came out a couple weeks ago. It's got Green Arrow, the Neil Adams Green Arrow Green Lantern cover.
Yes, I didn't know that was out.
And it's got a fucking, you know, to me, like a Holy Grail article, which is about Englehart's JLA. That's sweet, sweet reading right there. I have the weirdest taste as a fan for the shit that I write. You know, I mean, I just have a real love for that 70s Marvel. Not even, I mean, yeah, you know, the Gerber and the Starlin and stuff, but I, for some reason, I really like that Englehart, Michelinie kind of slightly skew, but I guess you could call it, you know, middle of the road superhero stuff, you know, like, I like Englehart on Avengers, and I like him on Batman, and I like him on JLA, much more so than I like him on Doctor Strange, for instance.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know what it is, but I don't know. Because I know that writers that are capable of, I mean, I like Gerber's Defenders a lot more than I like Howard the Duck.
Yeah, no, I do too.
Because knowing that he has Howard the Duck in him, when he writes straight superheroes, or what he does as straight superheroes, it's much more interesting. You know, and knowing that, like, David Michelinie came from DC doing, like, Swamp Thing and, you know, fucking, you know, Claw the Unconquered, like, really, like, fringe books. And then he comes over to Marvel and writes, like, Iron Man, The Avengers. Well, knowing that he came from that weird place makes the fact that he's writing Iron Man way more interesting.
Huh.
Than just some guy who's just kind of institutionalized writing the more mainstream characters. You know, but the odd thing is, I won't necessarily seek out Michelinie on, you know, writing Unknown Soldier or Claw or whatever the fuck he was doing at DC. I'm just not that into it. I'm into him doing Iron Man, you know?
Well, I think it's that idea of kind of seeing the creators push against the boundaries, even if it's not so apparent. It's like knowing that they are. I mean, you see that with the Defenders and Gerber. You see them kind of push against the boundaries of conventional superheroes, and you see that those walls bending a little bit. But then when he's doing Howard the Duck, he's just like, hey, I'm wacky. It's not the same.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's, to go back to kind of what we were saying earlier, I mean, that's why I will make sure that, you know, something like Butcher Baker, you know, fulfills its genre aspirations. You know what I mean?
Right,
there'll
yeah.
There'll be car chases and fights with bad guys and all the stuff that you want out of a superhero comic book. I wouldn't ever want to shortchange anybody on that. But at the same time, there's maybe a sliver of something extra that you could only get, well, in this case for me, but I want that out of any writer. You know, you want them to fulfill the genre expectations, but yet also be able to infuse what's uniquely their style, you know, as they're doing. I mean, they're doing two things at once, you know.
Are you reading any of the stuff that the guys from Comics Comics are calling fusion, that like King City or Orkstein or any of that stuff?
Orkstein I've looked at because the art is so good. But the subject matter, I'm just kind of like, you know, I mean, I'm just, you know, I don't want to spend any, and I know this is a broad generalization, but I just really don't have any hankering to spend a lot of time in any kind of Middle Earth bullshit scenario.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm not meaning to shortchange Orkstein, but I mean, it is of that genre, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, fully. I mean, obviously it plays against those tropes and it has a different sensibility, but it's fully in that kind of world, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just not a fan of the tropes, so whether or not he plays against them, I mean, I'm glad. I'd rather somebody play against them than not. But I, you know, it's just not. I'm not in on the ground floor. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, I think for me, I mean, everybody else who I read, all the other critics, you know, guys like Seneca and Witzke, they love that stuff, and I like it, and some of it's better. But to me, it's the art is the draw for all those comics, for all those kind of fusion comics. But that's kind of what's being talked about these days. Like, that's the kind of cutting edge kind of stuff that's out there, and it's not story based, really. It's not, or the narrative to me isn't the compelling part.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that, something like, I'm trying to think of stuff that I've read recently that, I mean, something like the Amazing Screw-On Head hardcover edition that came out. That
yeah.
Not only has the one shot, but has some other of his kind of what I call improv comics in there. That thing is it's so great, you know, because you know Mignola is, it's not a stretch, but he's taking a toe outside of that Hellboy narrative that he's so involved in.
Right.
You know? But it's also like this kind of, the fact that it stands alone. I mean, I thought the original Screw-On Head one shot was this, just this fantastic sort of object to art, you know,
mm-hmm.
that it got me on the one shot train. I would have never have bothered with something like Officer Down and it being just this, the one thing that it is, if it wasn't for that Screw-On Head one shot, you know.
Huh.
Really was, you know, such a cool thing. And I'm a Mignola fan, but I don't follow Hellboy religiously. I kind of read it when I'm in the mood to read it. But goddamn, that Screw-On Head thing is just amazing.
I really like the stuff he's doing with Richard Corbin. I mean, when Corbin comes in and draws the Hellboy, that's my favorite stuff, even though I love Mignola as an artist.
Yeah. But I don't know, I don't feel, I mean, I, what you don't get with anybody else drawing Hellboy, from Fregredo to Richard Corbin to anybody, is those moments of improv where he'll just throw in a little panel of a skull or a little panel of books on a bookshelf. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's just, you know, no one else is doing that shit. And, you know, that's, to me, pure cartooning. It's this kind of shit that, as a writer who doesn't draw, just like, God damn, I mean, I try to put that stuff in the books that I do, and it never really comes off, because you're asking an artist to do something that Mignola is totally improv, you know? But, you know, when I try to do it, it's very, when a writer and an artist try to do that same thing, it's very self-conscious.
Yeah, you know? It goes bannered at that point, yeah.
Moving towards the end a little bit, you're talking about Michelinie. Have you read any of his recent stuff at Marvel with Iron Man or anything like that? Do you go back to creators you liked when you were younger and look at their current output much?
I do, but, I mean, even they would argue that they're not the same writer. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and for me, it's not going to... I'll tell you the greatest thing. I guess it was 2 years ago at San Diego. I met for the first time, you know, which a guy I never thought I would meet, but I met Robert Lauren Fleming. And I was sitting there, I was at the Image table, and I was sitting there with Rob Liefeld and talking to him about stuff. And then Bob walked up, and I'd never seen him before. I'd never seen any pictures of him, but I saw his name. He was standing there because he knows Rob. And I saw his name tag. I was like, Bob Fleming, holy shit, I'm a huge fan of yours, you know. And Bob hasn't done, I mean, he was just coming back to do Ambush Bug, the return, whatever it's called, Year None or whatever it was called.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he was kind of dipping his toe back in the conflict water. And I saw him many times during that show and just was like, you're awesome, you know, just totally like waxing his car left and right. And he was, I think, taken aback by, you know, that anybody remembered him, really, you know. And got to know him, and we sort of exchanged emails and stuff. And then he started sending me stuff. I mean, I asked for it, but he told me that he'd kept all of the material that had to do with Thriller, from the pitch, from the initial pitch, through all the scripts he wrote.
Wow.
And I was like, who do I have to kill to see these things? So he sent it all to me. Big stack of photocopied stuff. And I was just like, holy cow. And then he sent me photocopies. DC in the mid-80s was going to do a weekly book, a weekly anthology book called Blockbuster. And it was going to be, the story's going to be 6 pages long. And DC had just acquired the Charlton characters. And Bob and Keith Giffen, doing the art, were going to do a Peacemaker serial. And so they did it. I mean, the book went into production. And so there was I don't know how many chapters, but, you know, probably like 12, 13, 14 chapters of this thing done, lettered, everything. And he sent these photocopies of this thing to me. And it was like, you know, I mean, obviously I'm a big fan of Giffen, but, you know, this was like being new work, but yet it was, you know, Bob Fleming and Keith Giffen circa 1985, which is exactly what you want them to be. And yet it was this, it wasn't revisited because it was new to me. I'd never seen this shit before. And oh my God, it delivers on so many levels. It's the wackiest fucking shit. There's a sequence where Peacemaker's helmet is sitting in the snow for a couple of pages and just, you know, like there's just like narration going on around it. It's just fucking bizarre. It's so oddball. And then what happened was the Blockbuster project went away, but this material existed. But the new editor of whatever that material was saw this thing and just hated it. And just was like, this ain't ever going to see print. And of course it never did see print.
Wow.
But to see this thing, it was like seeing, it was like a time capsule. It was like seeing a creator who you followed, and you knew that their modern stuff might not scratch the same itch, but this was new work from 1985. I mean, it's hard to describe that feeling of like not knowing that this thing even existed, and it being these creators who, for you, are in their fucking prime, you know, just completely in their prime, and in their weirdness prime, too. Because Giffen obviously went on to be a little more mainstream with, you know, Justice League and all that kind of stuff. But this was like full on Giffen in that, you know, Munoz ripoff controversy period, you know? Just fucking unreal. So it was like my favorite comic of the year, you know, that no one else ever saw. You know? So, I mean, I still like, I don't know, there's something in me that still sort of craves that shit, you know? And it's like, so that stack of, like, you know, thriller material is like one of my prized possessions, you know? It's one of those things where he photocopied the stuff for me, so he sent me this stack of photocopies, and I went out and photocopied it again so I could, like, take one stack and, like, put it away somewhere and, like, have this stack that I could actually read and, like, thumb through. And if it's not all up, it was okay because I had another version like in a vault somewhere. So that's how geeky I can get about the shit that I'm really, you know, passionate about, you know. So, you know, Chad, to kind of address the idea, I mean, the fact that you spent any time on your personal blog writing about anything of mine, I would not think anything about that except, you know, I mean, I think it's a cool thing. I mean, I want it to be like, wow, it's great that you wrote about me, but if you have anything like that, that, you know, anything that anybody gets passionate about, to me, it's, you know, that's the argument's over, you know. How can you have any bad feeling about something that somebody actually is into and puts thought into, you know?
Yeah, that's why we do it.
But I still,
I mean, we wouldn't do all this stuff if it wasn't something that excited us, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. But, Chad, I still have kind of a weird feeling about you, though.
Oh, I totally understand that. One of the things that I was just kind of trying to get at with creators doing, like, Michelinie and Leighton coming back to Iron Man, could you ever foresee a day where you would do something like Wildcats Forever, that picking up on old, like, 20 years from now, when nostalgia really kicks in for certain people and people like me become like editors and comics or whatever and want to somehow recapture that excitement from their youth. Could you see yourself going back to old characters and properties again?
No, because you can't. You can't recapture it. I mean, what's done is done. And what I find is that the things that I got out of writing Wildcats, and that I hope that readers got, I can take those ideas and still follow them in other work. You know what I mean? It has little to do with the characters. I mean, you got to tell me, what was it about Wildcats? It certainly wasn't about finding out what the fuck Grifter does next.
Oh, God,
is it?
No, not well, really. It was about, like I said, like that idea of like what happens to soldiers after the war is over. What about like how can you treat a corporation like a superhero? Like stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, those interests, I still am interested in those things, and those will carry on in other works. I mean, the soldier after the war thing. I mean, that there's Butcher Baker kind of right there. So if that was something that interested you, then I'm going to continue to explore those themes and those ideas. It just won't be with those characters. So I never feel like there's any reason to revisit something. It's because I don't feel the need. I mean, in the case of Wildcats, there are maybe a few plot elements that I wish I could have kept that tied up or somehow just kept, you know, writing. But those are such, they don't compare to the bigger ideas, which I have complete freedom to explore in other places, you know? Or I could read Fraction's Iron Man and watch it play out there.
No, I like that answer.
Especially my dig at Fraction, who's a friend of mine. I liked it. I'm getting punchy. Is that true? I haven't been reading that. That is what's going on in that book, isn't it?
What's going on in the book is that he's fighting against the next generation of, like, the sons and daughters of his former villains, basically.
Yeah, but isn't his company, isn't there like a car that runs forever, and isn't that what he's trying to do?
Yeah, the supercar thing, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I just, you know.
Yeah, Chad stopped reading that comic a long time ago, but I'm sticking with it.
Okay. So I'm not wrong, right? I mean, that's a familiar piece of idea then, right?
Yes.
Okay. As Stan Lee would say, enough said. I love Fraction, If he can make it work better than I did, then God bless him. You know, more power to him.
Yeah, and I can't even think of an example where someone came back to something after years, and it was anything more than the initial excitement about that person coming back, and then kind of, oh yeah, okay, you can't really go home again.
I think the only one that came close, I mean, I really liked, but I think that's because he, you know, I mean, he's just good, so it sort of trumps any other argument. When Grant went back and did that JLA Classified, it was really just a prelude to Seven Soldiers.
Yeah.
But those were some pretty goddamn good comics, you know, as good, if not better, than anything he'd done in JLA. You know?
Yeah, well, I think McGinnis on art helped a ton on that.
Yeah. But, well, yeah, that's true. But, I mean, to get McGinnis to actually do more complex storytelling is a feat in and of itself, and believe me, I know.
Yeah, I can only think of a couple examples. Like, I'm a big fan of Frank Miller's Dark Knight Strikes Again, or even some of Starlin's return to writing and drawing Thanos with, like, Infinity Abyss and Marvel The End. I really think those are better than people tend to think they are.
But even Dark Knight Strikes Again is like such a completely separate work.
Oh yeah.
Whereas a lot of people who come back to it, like whether it's the, you know, the Giffen, Maguire, formerly the Justice League thing, or Paul Levitz coming back to Legion, like they're trying to do the same thing, and it can be kind of pleasant, and I guess it could be kind of comfort food kind of comics, but it's, you know, it's not the same.
It's never the same thing because, you know, the things that, I mean, let's take, the Giffen, the Mattis, and McGuire, you know, I can't believe it. Just whatever that shit was called. Those were great times, entertaining, whatever. Not even, to me, didn't hold a candle to what they did in that first year of Justice League, because at all. It's, you know, they were doing, you know, fairly straightforward superhero comics with kind of a behind the music kind of bent, the behind the scenes kind of bent. And it wasn't until, I don't know, probably, you know, way into this year two that it started to be more of a comedy book.
Right.
As opposed to a more well-rounded superhero adventure. I mean, look, when I had Giffen on the Defenders thing that we did, I was able to say to him, look, you know, because he was willing to have more jokes.
Right.
And I was like, that is not the Keith Giffen I'm interested in working with. I want, you know, the guy who is Keith has kind of been, he's kind of come around. I don't think Doom Patrol is particularly a yuck fest. It's got its moments, but he plays it fairly straight, you know, and that's the Giffen I like, you know. I don't like, I think the joke machine is fun and entertaining, but that's not the work that affected me the most that he's done, you know.
Yeah, no.
Right. What other comics can I pontificate on here?
Well, so Giffen is actually going to be drawing a couple issues of DiDio's Outsiders. Like that. That's
a couple.
Weird.
I heard he's going to be the regular artist.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Regular. Yes, he's going to be the regular artist. I don't know how long it's going to last, but that blows my mind.
Yeah.
That's a weird pairing.
It's still not enough to get me to read Outsiders by then.
What are you reading right now that you're really digging?
Oh my god. Shit, man. Now you put me on the spot. I tend to kind of gravitate. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, you know, Grant's Batman stuff I'm digging, obviously. That's probably some of the only serialized stuff. I mean, the things that I like tend to be more, I don't want to say not event comics because that connotates something else, but like, you know, I like the Strange Tales stuff that's coming out from Marvel right now, I dig. And I liked, although it wasn't to me sort of prime Brendan McCarthy, I liked Spider-Man Fever. I like, X'd Out, I like, Wilson, I like, you know, these kind of, events are the only way I can describe them. They kind of come out, they make a statement and they're over in a way, you know. There's not a lot of continuing conversations that I'm, you know, having with any comics right now. Because I've seen it all. Nothing's really blowing my skirt off that I'm going, wow, this is a really great take on Aquaman. I mean, that's just not my mindset anymore. If somebody came along and had this radical take on Aquaman, I'd be right there, you know. I mean, I looked at the way that, you know, those guys did the Wednesday comic strip. If, you know, Carl Kershaw was doing The Flash every month in the way he did it in Wednesday comics, I'd be so there. You know, I thought that was genius. If Paul Pope was going to do a monthly Adam Strange comic, I'm there. There's no question about it. But that's that kind of, you know, effort, in my opinion, is not happening in monthly comics right now. You know, that kind of attention to really, you know, it's not even pushing the envelope. It's just, I just don't see, I mean, I'm interested in, even in work for hires like this. It, you know, if I don't see any personal expression going on, I have no interest, you know. And just servicing a franchise, it's just not enough to hook me in, you know. And I'm a sucker for anything where I feel like that's going on. You know, you just name any goofy character. If I feel like something special is happening there with the creator involved, I don't have any aversion to buying, you know, just name the comic that you never think you would buy. Deadpool Max. I'd buy Deadpool Max if I really thought there was you know, something really great there going on that I hadn't seen before. But, I feel like, shit jokes I've seen before. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Deadpool Max is pretty good. It's better than you might think, mm-hmm. even though you've read about it. But, I know what you mean. Like, I never thought I'd buy Ghost Rider, but Jason Aaron's Ghost Rider was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm feeling the same way about Doc Savage right now with Ivan Brandon and Nick Klein on that.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Well, let's see there. I mean, that just proves it right there. I mean, it's a total different strokes for different folks. I mean, I see everything that comes out, I mean, you have to look at what's going on. And I don't consider myself cynical. It takes a lot to hook me in, And it's funny because it's going to be interesting because Grant's about to, after this first story arc with Yannick Paquette, it's going to be Burnham doing a story arc.
Yeah, I saw that.
And not for nothing, but I got him that gig. But,
nice.
That's neither here nor there. But it's going to be interesting to read that comic because, to me, that's going to be really inside baseball, Watching a guy that I've worked with, I kind of one of the first guys to work with him, and Grant, who's a good friend and one of my favorite writers in comics, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm also kind of dreading it. I'm wondering what kind of experience as a reader it's going to be. I mean, I'm sure it'll be great, and from a craft level, it's going to be fantastic. And the fact that I kind of know what the story is kind of helps too. But it's so seeing the strings that I don't know how I'm going to react to it. Which I'd love to just react to as a fan, but I'm kind of past that now with almost every comic. Because whether or not I know the guys personally, or I know the behind the scenes stuff that that other people aren't privy to, or anything like that, I mean, it does inform the experience, I kind of get a little bit melancholy about it sometimes because it really is. I've left the fan way behind. Because I'm just, you have to. When you turn pro, you have to you have to leave some things behind. Otherwise, it's going to be a detriment to your work, but that, it's kind of a shame. So, Chad, you say Doc Savage, and my knee-jerk reaction goes, oh my God, Christ, Doc Savage, really? I get kind of, a bit too acerbic about it. More than I should be. Really, so that's why I was kind of like, that's why that reaction kind of happened. I couldn't help myself.
Have you seen the Ivan Brandon Nick Klein stuff, or are you thinking of the first few issues?
I'm probably a few months behind what's out.
Yeah, because there was an initial story arc with Howard Porter on art, and that was,
right.
I read the first issue and I hated that, but then I think with issue 5 or 6, Azzarello is co-plotting with Ivan Brandon and Nick Klein, who did Viking with him.
Right.
And it's definitely a lot better than the book, how the book started at least.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I'm a Howard Porter fan. I think the guy's great. I mean, I know he had some thing where he had his hand got fucked up or something. And he's kind of, but I mean, I thought that he was a really good match for Grant on JLA. I thought, when he worked with Jeff on The Flash, he was great on The Flash, I mean, and even him on Doc Savage, I thought, that's interesting. That's an interesting artistic pairing, because you always feel like Doc Savage, the knee-jerk Doc Savage image is always those painted covers, those painted images from, from what are the 60s or the 70s, from the paperback novels, I guess. And you just never picture Doc Savage with sort of that harder line that Howard Porter has. So when it first came out, I checked it out, but I kind of looked at it more than I read it. And the stuff that I read, I was like, I still don't get what Doc Savage's powers are, you know, what he is.
Yeah, I mean, that opening arc was just unreadable, and I always thought Doc Savage could be such a fascinating character, and I have so rarely seen it done in any sort of capacity.
Yeah, I was hoping that first issue would tell me who Doc Savage was and what he did. And
yeah,
then
it had nothing at all that gave you any kind of clue as to what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I looked on Wikipedia, I couldn't even suss out what the fuck that he did. What he, you know? And he's an iconic character, and I'm kind of drawn to that character because he's sustained, and obviously he's survived. But it's like, what the fuck is he, man? You know, the Man of Bronze, but does that just mean...
He's tanned?
Yeah, or does he have a good tan, or is he actually made of bronze? I honestly don't know. And this is my fucking business to know this shit, and I have no fucking clue.
Yeah. Doc Savage.
But Chad, is Ivan explaining him better? Do you know what the fuck he is and what he does? Come on, man, enlighten us.
I would say he's... I'm trying to think of how to phrase it. He's just the ultimate human in the same kind of way Batman is at times, except even better. Like, peak physical condition, basically as close to being a superhuman without being actually having superpowers. Just the toughest, strongest, quickest, smartest person possible.
But so why is he the Man of Bronze, though?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I've never understood that either.
Yeah.
I mean, the best version of Doc Savage is the Alan Moore, Tom Strong stuff.
Yeah, but Tom Strong doesn't have a visual that connotes some other thing. I mean, he's Tom Strong. He's a guy in a t-shirt, you know? He's the Man of Bronze. He's got that... Is that a skull cap? Is that his hair?
That's his hair, I think.
Is it? Jesus Christ. I mean, I would not have known that. I thought it was a skull cap. I thought it was some kind of relic of the 1930s. Like, hey, people, like jodhpurs. Like, people wore that.
The jodhpurs and skull cap fashion combination.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, that's what you wore when you... rode some weird animal that's not indigenous to America. You know?
And your white shirt has to be just appropriately ripped, just to the right places.
And, you know, open down to your navel.
Yes.
Yeah. See, I wonder if the Man of Bronze thing comes from just sort of like, it's just meant to be like a tagline, like Superman's the Man of Steel or whatever, and then some artist took it too literally and actually drew him as if he was made out of bronze, and that's just become his look.
But even the Man of Steel, bullets bounce off the Man of Steel. You know what I mean? It wasn't just because of his attitude, you know?
I'm sure somebody actually knows the answer to this, but I always just interpret it as the Man of Bronze, like, he's statuesque, like, it's a Shakespearean metaphor. He's like the Man of Bronze. He's awesome.
Yeah.
That's horrible. That's a horrible reason.
It's a metaphor.
For what? You know, sunbeds? I mean, I don't get it.
It didn't help that in the DC Comics, he was just orange, like bright, bright orange.
I know. I mean, you know, I'm willing to believe that he was fucking exposed to the goddamn Terrigen mist. You know what I mean? I'll take that. Just give me something to hang my hat on. There's nothing. Doesn't he have like a school for how to be perfect or something? He's got like a... Like, he runs a university or something, doesn't he?
I haven't seen that yet, but that could be in some version
probably.
Of him.
Yeah, maybe that was something I picked up off Wikipedia.
I don't know, guys. I think we might want to wrap this up.
I know. We're pontificating Doc fucking Savage. You know?
Well, my note actually says, too much talk about Doc Savage.
Yeah, oh, good. So you can edit that shit out?
Oh, no, I don't do that.
No. Oh, okay.
I don't know, gentlemen. Any final thoughts?
Are you really going to run this as one podcast?
People seem to like these big 3-hour ones. I don't know why. I don't like them as a listener myself, but other people, they love it.
Why? And what's... Do they have a reason? Are they taking long trips and they just need something that will
I actually like the long ones as a listener. When there's like a 2 or 3 hour podcast, because it takes me like a week to get through it on my commute to work, and it feels like an ongoing conversation the whole time.
Yeah, but isn't it? But do you feel like, you know how if you're driving in your car and you're playing a CD or you're playing the radio, and you get to your destination and you turn off the car in the middle of a song, that song is in your head for all the time you're out of the car until you get back in the car. I mean, God forbid you're listening to the radio and you don't get that closure, because when you turn the car back on, the radio just has some other song. At least with a CD, you can finish the song.
Right.
But, I mean, imagine a podcast would be like that times a fucking million, you know? Like, you have these just voices in your head carrying on a conversation that you can't engage in, but they're still having it, you know?
God, now I have visions of people walking around with my voice in their head all day. That is awful. That's cruel.
They get to, it's something for them to look forward to. I mean, obviously their lives are miserable, and so it gives them something to look forward to all day.
But it would be more, in the case of a podcast where people are talking, it'd seem more like a record skipping, like, you know, just the same subject being discussed in your head for like the 2 hours walking on the mall, you know. I mean, people are going to be like, yeah, Doc Savage, what the fuck is he? Well, Doc Savage, what the fuck is he? Doc Savage, what the fuck is he? Until they can get back in the car and they see that we don't know. There's no closure to that subject, you know?
I used to break up the podcast into more manageable, like 40-minute to an hour chunks, and people didn't seem to like that as much as just letting it go for 3 hours.
But don't you feel like if you broke a 3 hour podcast up into 3 bite-sized hour chunks, that you could, instead of it being a sort of weekly delivery format, you could have things that happen every 3 days. I mean, you'd keep people on the hook a little bit more, you know?
We did it first, and people seem to respond to this way better. I don't know why.
Okay. I know, I feel, why am I telling you your business? I'm just...
We don't understand our business either.
I mean, if we had advertising or anything, like if there were any possible gain for getting more downloads of individual episodes, it might be worth breaking them up, but it doesn't matter at this point.
You mean the artist of that goddamn song you play at the beginning of every one isn't paying you to constantly play that song?
No, I keep waiting to hear from some sort of legal team telling us to take it out.
Chad, when you say out, you're so fucking Canadian. That is genius.
I wasn't aware me saying out sounded Canadian.
It really does, to be honest.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
I mean, that's not a pejorative. I'm just pointing it out to you.
No, that's, yeah, I'm, yeah.
And you are Canadian, right?
I am indeed.
Well, there you go. You're just speaking naturally. This is,
I think we're done. We have nothing else to say.
So yeah. Let's all thank Joe Casey for joining us.
Thank you, Joe Casey, for
everybody,
joining us.
This is where all the people listening to the podcast are supposed to applaud and stand up and such.
This is a masterful episode.
Is this it for me? I'm never coming back, am I? I mean, this is kind of...
I think you should be a regular weekly guest.
You're welcome back anytime.
I'll come back when I know what the fuck Doc Savage is.
Come back and report on that and provide visuals.
Or when you have another book to show.
Well, that might be sooner than you think. I mean, we didn't even talk about Marijuana Man, you know. Let me tell you something, fellas. That's going to be way cooler than you picture it being.
Marijuana Man?
Oh, yeah.
It almost have to be.
Exactly. I mean, we can only go up from there, right? but this will be the last thing I say, and just to end on a pimp. It is awesome. I mean, it's more Kafka-esque than you would think.
Awesome.
If I can use that, you know, put the esque on something, a work of my own, you know, it's a lot more, you know, sort of in that vein than just some, like, I don't know what you'd call it, in the category of celebrity comics or whatever. We are, you know, we're definitely treating it as though it's just our own thing. So I think that's going to be out in April. 420, of course, you know.
Really?
For anyone who
has Wednesday actually 4:20?
Yeah.
It's actually, wow.
Yeah.
That's...
Oh, I know. Like it was meant to be, right?
Oh, my God. It's true. I just looked it up on a calendar.
I think the Mayans had that in their calendar. Like, 2011, 4:20 is going to be falling on Wednesday. After that, it's all over. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, we all know what we'll be doing on that day.
Buying comics.
That's right.
Pretty much.
All right. Thanks again, Joe Casey.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I'm glad that the technology was finally served us.
Never a doubt. Never a doubt.
No, not in my mind at all.
All right. Cool.
All right. I'll hang up now. Bye, guys.
Take care, guys. I'll talk to you later.